Detroit.
Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. It's good to be back. We missed last week because of the holiday. Hi, Julene.
Hello, Peter.
A few things have happened in our area. Oh, man. Everything's going crazy, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And, you know, I did a little experiment. I did some yoga tonight before
really?
I came in. Yeah, because I'm so pissed off at BP and at what the Israeli army did to the folks that were going to give humanitarian aid to the folks in Gaza. I mean, I just have been in a tizzy all week. I'm feeling pretty mellow, but I have a feeling I can get worked up all over again.
Well, I know what you mean. Actually, I turned on ABC News the other night. First thing they showed were images of an oil-soaked pelican. And I said, they hadn't even begun. You know, they had little teasers. I turned it off. I can't deal with it.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time dealing with it.
So apparently this containment cap that they put over this well is capturing a lot more of the crude pouring from the damage to oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. But the government now is warning that the crisis could stretch into the fall.
Which means it will.
Yeah.
Maybe even longer.
And, you actually think if they say one thing, something else
yeah,
might occur?
Yeah, I know. Right. Call me crazy.
Hey, you're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. It's a phone-in talk show, and our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Actually, it's our only number, but it's just said two different ways. If you'd like to email us, if like the lines are busy, and let me see, I haven't even looked at our lines. I suspect probably as usual at the beginning, completely open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. Anything you'd like to comment on, we'd like to hear from you. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com is our email address if the lines are filled or if you are bashful. We have a Facebook. You just go to facebook.com/nightcall, friends wanted. And Jade is answering your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And through her diligent work, and she has been working this weekend.
She is. Oh boy.
Still,
I said it's a good thing you're young. You know?
Yeah. Still, she will have the podcast up by noon tomorrow, Monday. And the best way, really, is to subscribe to the podcast. It's free. Just go to WRIF.com, and what that does for you, then you get sent the podcast whenever it is put up.
Pretty slick.
Well, we're coming down to, what's that, 0 hour, is that it? That's right, I guess what they call it, for the United States Social Forum. And it occurs to me,
which is happening here in Detroit in just a couple of weeks.
June 22nd to the 26th, and someone told me that it sounds like kind of a dating get-together. Because usually when people hear the phrase social, if you have a social forum, you would think that couples are going to meet one another. But actually, this is a convergence of, young people, people of color, unionists, laid off and unorganized workers, welfare recipients, veterans, people with disabilities, indigenous people, people all over this country that are trying to grasp what's going on here and to make some fundamental changes from the ground up. It's not hoping that one set of elites will do us better than the other one.
Right.
I mean, that's what happened. I mean, we were so filled with hope, the audacity of hope in 2008 that this one man would come riding in on a stallion and fix all the problems. Well, I mean, probably the problems are beyond his capacity anyways.
Agreed.
Given how things are currently structured, it's pretty hard for anyone to operate outside of it. And particularly, like, Republicans don't even want to operate outside of it. Does Barack Obama? Who knows? He says he does, but we don't get much.
He needs to get on it.
Yeah. And when you see his popularity dropping, who it's dropping with are people like me and Jolene and a lot of you. I mean, it's not like suddenly the right wing has gotten a lot of popularity. Remember those people? What were they called? The bag tears or the
the tea baggers.
Oh, yeah, I remember them. They kind of were a big flash. It's nothing about them. It's the disappointment that so many people had in what it appeared as Barack Obama promised. He didn't really promise a lot, although there's some direct promises that he's gone back on. But it was more what he represented. It represented this desire for peace and social justice, for economic stability, for environmental sense and all that. And everything's gone in the opposite direction. Absolutely. Some of it, he has just gone along, he being the president, has gone along the same route that, what was the guy before him?
Bushy.
Oh, yeah, Bushy. Has, like in Afghanistan. Other than, who would have known that this curveball would have been thrown to the planet and the seas and the animals and the people that depend on the seas for a living, the people that live along that coast. But it occurs to me that all of this, if it has any, and I guess it doesn't have any bright side to it, that it ends any further debate on whether or not there should be any more drilling, almost anywhere. I mean, drilling is poisonous everywhere, even if it's on land. It does such damage to the environment around it. And then it's shipped, it's terrible. It's processed, it's terrible. It's burned in any of our cars, it's terrible. And
it's toxic!
It's toxic. So, almost everyone among us, the ordinary people, know it's time to get rid of this historic mistake. Fossil fuel, coal, oil, all of that. Clean coal, what a bunch of crap. Nuclear, don't even start me. I mean, talk about impossible stuff. So it's time to move on. I mean, the debate seems over. And you still have these shrill people instead of are still saying drill, baby, drill. Whether it's spill, baby, spill. It also shows.
And it's kill, baby, kill.
Hey, you know what? I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
You're right. That anything like this, if it's going to continue, and I'm not going to fall back from an absolutist position that this stuff has got to end tomorrow. All this fossil fuel stuff, goodbye. I mean, the sun, the water, all of this has got to take its place. The wind, that there's a book called Internal Combustion, and I interviewed the author. One of you will remember his name. He also wrote about the role of IBM in the Holocaust.
I remember that.
IBM put together the whole punch card system so the Nazis could take care of the Jews that they exterminated. But in any event, that it was how the internal combustion engine took hold over everything else. Thomas Edison wanted to do it all by wind power, and he had an idea. I'm not sure that this is exactly the best way to go, but he wanted to have electric cars, and he wanted to have a windmill at everyone's home. That you would be
great
able to
idea.
Fill, you'd do your electricity, you'd be completely off the grid. I mean, who knows if it would work on a society the size of ours now. But the idea was not, this idea of alternative fuels is not an old, not a new one, rather, not a new one at all. But if there's going to be any more drilling at all, and I say, I don't want to retreat in the slightest from an absolutist position about getting rid of this stuff immediately and substituting it for other sources of power, that it needs the absolute strictest regulation imaginable. I mean, that was part of the problem, is that that so many people in politics, and I'll get to that in a minute, you may have seen this on the news already, are in bed with the oil companies. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that these people have. And does anybody still want to debate whether or not that greed rules all to the detriment of safety and the environment and the long-term health of any number of species, including ours? It's all over. It's all over. That debate is over. This this story here from the Associated Press demonstrates a need for investigative reporting, because that's beginning to go away. All these newsrooms and newspapers and even on television, they're beginning to just eliminate their news departments because, hey, who needs all that? Well,
who needs to be informed?
Yeah. Kurt Anderson, the AP legal affairs writer, writes, more than half of the federal judges in districts where the bulk of the Gulf oil spill-related lawsuits are pending have financial connections to the oil and gas industry. Mm. Want to hear that one again? More than half the federal judges in the districts where the bulk of Gulf oil spill-related lawsuits are pending have financial connections to the oil and gas industry.
Good news for the industry.
Yeah. So this is a racket, pure and simple. a racket, pure and simple. 37 of the 64 active or senior judges in key Gulf Coast districts in Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi and Florida have links to oil, gas, and related energy industries, including some who own stocks or bonds in BP, Halliburton, or Transocean. Others who regularly list receiving royalties from oil and gas production wells, according to reports that they must file each year. George Carlin, you ever hear that they own you?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you just Google, they own you, and it's all there. One of the things he says, at least the Republicans don't pretend they aren't whores.
Oh, jeez. That's funny.
And this is another reason. Stuff like this is the way people are retreating from support of Democratic Party candidates. I mean, one thing about the Republicans, they vote for local or national fascists that promise order and patriotism, you know, the usual rubbish that they fly their flags in front of these gullible right-wingers. And it doesn't matter what sort of scandals they're involved in, how far from the mark their personal lives or their politics are from the status of the people that are voting for them. In other words, you know, they're totally 100% in bed with the big corporations, the Republicans, and the Democrats are only, what, about 60%?
Yeah, only.
So they're better than a stick in the eye. The Republicans are a stick in the eye, and the Democrats are better than a stick in the eye. Well, we can do better than that. And that gets back to what I was talking about, the U.S. Social Forum that's going to be here in Detroit June 22nd to the 26th. You can go to their website at USSF2010.org. USSF, like in Frank. USSF2010.org, or go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And, yeah, if you just sort of stumbled by this show and, I don't know, whatever, man, that's one thing. But a lot of you profess this grave concern about the direction of this country. And you can't just do it by having an attitude in your individual head. You can't look at Fox News or CNN or even MSNBC and go, yeah, man, I'm not buying the BS. You know, I'm my own person. I know that this is all a racket. I know that these guys are all crooks. I know that they're all lying if they got a suit or a uniform on and they're on television. You know, that's a start. But it doesn't do you any good. It's not going to change anything. The power that is that resides in these elites that rule us at every level is not going to be altered by a thought in your head. We have to get together. We have changed America. Do you think the elites ever wanted to change anything in this country? Do you think they wanted to abolish slavery? Do you think they wanted to give the vote to women? Do you think they wanted to unionize? Do you think that they wanted to do anything that didn't just put more money in their pocket? Of course not. So it was always, always up to us. We, the people. One of the things we're talking about, these judges that are that have financial connections to the oil and gas industry. Let's see. One federal judge in Texas is a member of Houston's Petroleum Club, an exclusive handsome club of and for men of the oil industry. So this is your
gag me
federal. This is your federal judge.
You know, there's someone came up with a couple of good ideas of what to do about the oil leak, what to cap that with, and someone suggested shoving Sarah Palin down there. I joined that group, and I also joined one to shove all the BP executives down there. So I just say we put them all in there together.
There you go.
And everyone who says drill, baby, drill, you can go in there too.
Yeah. They're actually we should get to, because the situation in Israel with this blockade of Gaza is heating up again. But it's absolutely amazing. First, I...
And this is where, how many people were killed, Peter, in that?
Nine people were shot to death by the invading
Israeli army. Because they were on a ship called the Rachel Corrie.
No.
That was a different one, right?
That was a different one, yeah.
Anyway, because there was a bunch of ships. How many? Three or four Turkish ships that went over there? I think.
There were six that left. This was the big incident that happened last Monday. I think it was May 31st. And there was one big cruise ship that had about 500 people on it. Then there were five smaller ships. They had a lot of prestigious people on there as well. But actually, before I get to that, I wanted to at least get one good thing. And, you know, it is so depressing to hear prejudicial remarks from people. And I'm always amazed, for instance, it usually comes up in racist remarks. So idiot will make some racial derogatory remarks. Sometimes, you know, I've heard anti-Arab remarks from people that they assume that you hold the same stupid prejudice as they do.
They assume that it's okay for them to verbalize it. Period. Yeah. I had a run-in with someone recently who was referring to something that was completely racist against African Americans. And it was referring to sitting on their front porch.
Yeah.
That term, know that?
Yeah, yeah.
And listen, I attacked the guy. I went after him to the point where, I mean, we had it out. It was lucky we were, not violent people, because we probably would have punched each other.
Well,
this is a white guy. I go, you cannot say that. You cannot say that. Well, my girlfriend's black. I can say it. I said, it doesn't matter. And her laughing about it is because she's uncomfortable. She probably doesn't want to confront you. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, this is actually good news that according to these polls that have just come out, for the first time, the percentage of Americans who perceive gay and lesbian relations as the morally acceptable has crossed the 50% mark.
I actually, to be honest with you, I can't believe it's not more already. Good, I guess.
Yeah. Well, also for the first time, the percentage of men who hold that view is greater than the percentage of women who do.
Yeah, they're just thinking about the ladies.
Yeah. The new alignment.
That's
is being
hot, right?
Calm down. The new alignment is being led by a dramatic change in attitudes among younger men. Hey, by the way, almost everybody that is waiting to get on the line at 313-298-WRIF wants to talk about the oil spill, and we'll get to that. Or actually, you will get to that as well. So hang on, and we'll get that on. Let's see. So here are this was in an article called "Gay Whatever, Dude."
great
from
title.
The New York Times, and there are three theories why. The contact hypothesis: as more men openly acknowledge that they are gay, it becomes harder for men who are not gay to discriminate against them. Also, they realize as openly gay men, including athletes, celebrities, soldiers, politicians, the Republican gay politicians, they're totally closeted, voting against gay rights.
Absolutely.
And on the other
hypocrites.
Hand. Hypocrites. Yeah, hypocrites, right. The people that personally knew someone who was gay or lesbian were more likely to be accepting of gay men and lesbians in general. Hello? Yeah. Men may be becoming more egalitarian in general. Men have gotten increasingly comfortable with the presence of and relative equality of, quote, the other, and we're becoming more accustomed to it. Well, thank you.
Guys, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. And three, virulent homophobes, people that hate homosexuals, are increasingly being exposed for engaging in homosexuality.
We all knew that. We knew that all along.
Yeah. Think Ted Haggard, the once fervent anti-gay preacher and former leader of the National Association of Evangelicals, and his male prostitute.
And that little white powder they were snorting.
That's right. Or George Rakers, the founding member of the Family Research Council, and his rent boy luggage.
I love that story.
Yeah. So that's what's going on. Also, this is astounding. In Sao Paulo, Brazil, over 3 million gay people marched in the Gay Pride March.
My gosh.
In South America's largest city. Dancing to music blasting from sound trucks on Sunday, they condemned homophobia and demanded equal rights. They said they would push candidates in this year's Brazil's presidential election. A river of gay men, lesbians, cross-dressers, and even heterosexual couples flowed down skyscraper lined Avenida Paulista, which is billed as the world's biggest gay pride parade. And there was also a gay pride the festival in Ferndale.
Yes.
Today. The mayor is an openly gay man. I can't think of his first name. Covey.
Craig Covey.
Craig. Yeah. Craig Covey. I interviewed him.
In fact, he was down there, I think. I breezed through. A friend of mine performed at it, and it got rained. I mean, for me, it rained, and I left. But, boy, really, every walk of life down there. And we should be proud here of that celebration, because it is well attended. It's not 3 million people.
No, no. Craig Covey, I interviewed him, and I for WRF, and I said, congratulations on being Michigan's first gay mayor. And he says, well, a correction here, Michigan's first open gay mayor. I said, you want to name the others? He said, you'd be surprised.
Oh, my.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Malawi's president on Saturday pardoned that gay couple who had been sentenced to 14 years in prison and ordered their release, but insisted that homosexuality was still illegal in his conservative African nation. Malawi is among 37 African countries with anti-gay laws.
Yeah, and the thing is, now, what is this couple supposed to do? I mean, they need to probably
get out. After the pardon, activists were searching for a safe house for the couple, fearing they could be attacked upon release.
Right.
I was
actually surprised about that reversal.
Actually, so was I. Did you realize that Rush Limbaugh just got married?
Did you see the picture? The young...
33. He's 60.
Yeah.
And he married Catherine Rogers, 33.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who sang for him?
Elton John.
Well, Elton John, you know, all these
people... I'm a little disappointed in Elton,
I
have to
also
say.
Elton John is one of the performers who has refused to cancel his appearance in Israel. Everybody is canceling left and right.
He's losing me. And I've always been such a fan. You know, Van Morrison lost me.
Yeah.
8 years ago.
Because he played at Bush's inaugural?
Yeah. Yep. I still play it on the air, but...
Elton John, Sir Elton, was paid a cool $1 million.
Whoa! Now I get it.
Yeah. From Rush for the Wedded Blissful performance. And also Rod Stewart is going to appear in Israel as well. Elton John played for the 400 guests, including former George W. This is a mistake here. It says former George W. Oh, no. I'm sorry. I didn't read the whole sentence. Former George W. Bush advisor Karl Rove.
Oh, geez.
Actor-politician Fred Thompson. Fox News commentator Sean Hannity and former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Still not in jail, huh?
You know, if I had been in that room, when I left, I would have to probably dip myself in a bucket of acid to remove the slime.
Well, here, this is from a far right-wing newspaper, which I won't even give its title, not wanting to give them any publicity. But Republican House Minority Leader John Boehner is demanding... Isn't that his name?
I can't remember. I always go to Boehner, though.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
I think sometimes they call him Boehner?
No, you call him Boehner.
Boehner. Well,
I actually do know what his name is, but I like saying Boehner better.
Well, wait a minute. It's Boehner.
Yeah, it's Boehner.
How do you pronounce H-O-E-H-N-E-R?
Boehner.
Boehner, the harmonica.
Yep.
So it's John Boehner.
And he knows it.
So he's demanded an apology from Sir Paul McCartney for taking what this paper calls a cheap shot at former President George W. Bush. They say that getting this prize, he got this prize from President Obama, which was the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song.
And he performed there.
And he performed there, and he said getting this prize was just would just be good enough, but getting it from this president, he said, letting his praise trail off as if it were vast volumes left unsaid. And then McCartney quipped, after the last 8 years, it's great to have a president who knows what a library is. Yeah. They call it a baseless cheap shot.
Well, and it's Paul McCartney, I love you more than ever.
Yeah, but it's...
Cue the McCartney.
Well, it was a cheap shot, but it's not baseless.
Right, it is not baseless.
Yeah.
No.
So, Representative Boehner says, like millions of other Americans, I've always had a good impression of Paul McCartney and thought of him as a classy guy, but I was surprised and disappointed by the lack of grace and respect he displayed at the White House. Yeah, probably. So what? But he says, the author says, McCartney is the third recipient of the Gershwin Prize. Hailing from England and having no university degrees of his own, the Beatle may not know that W. was the first American president to earn a master's degree in business administration.
Oh.
Yeah, you could tell what a smart guy he is.
Yeah.
The fact that the MBA is from Harvard really irks the left. What?
What?
That is not one of the things that irks me about George W. Bush.
No.
Not to mention that Bush is married to a librarian. Doesn't this person
have
an editor?
Yeah, and a former drug dealer.
Yeah.
Dimebag Laura.
Yeah. Although she's turning out to be kind of liberal.
She is.
Yeah.
She is. And did you know that she likes reggae music? I'm telling you, she sold pot in college.
She did.
Yeah.
And this was written by Connie Hare, H-A-I-R. Bush, here's what does irk me about Bush. Bush was at the Economic Club of Grand Rapids, on June 3rd, and he said he had no regrets about waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, saying that if it presented with the same opportunity, he'd do it again.
Oh, we're so surprised by this.
Yeah. So this is like a public admission of a war crime? Because this is it is illegal. U.S. soldiers have been prosecuted for during like the Spanish-American War, during the suppression of the Philippines, where the U.S. killed hundreds of thousands of Filipinos who didn't want to be ruled by Spain or the U.S., but soldiers waterboarded people there, as they did in Vietnam, and in both cases were prosecuted within the military. He says, we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I'd do it again to save lives. He said, nobody seriously that knows anything about the situation thinks any lives were saved. And what was the number of times they waterboarded him? It was like 8 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he probably just learned to hold his breath. Bush also defended his decision to invade Iraq during the speech, despite the fact that weapons of mass destruction were never found. Well, that's just a little incidental there. So this is what irks me about him. Let's see, if you go to my website or probably other places as well, mine is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, we see that 4,402 Americans have died in Iraq, and a few die every week. I look at all the news sites, I never see how any of them died. It's just like 1, 2, 3, 4 Americans die, and there's some family in Iowa or California or Michigan or someplace like that that gets this news that their son has died in Iraq. Or now the American GI toll in Afghanistan is 1,089. And there's been over 100,000 U.S. wounded in Iraq. So Bush says the world is a better place without him. Well, hey, George, the world's a better place without you as the president.
Yeah.
But the damage you've
created
done to so many people. So this guy belongs in the dock at the, and not, you know, not with his boat shoes on, but rather in the criminal dock at the International Court of Justice, to be sure.
I don't know. When you mention Bush, GW, and shoes, all I think about is...
Oh, the guy that threw the shoes.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Here's Jason in Port Huron. He's our first caller at 313-298-WRIF, and you're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan. Hey, Jason, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I love you guys' show. No, I'm just curious. Most companies all have emergency plans in place when something happens. And it seems to me, BP, being such a big company, you think that it has some sort of idea of how to fix this problem right away?
Yeah, you would think, but that partly is their fault. But, you know, you can't depend on these corporations, as I'm sure you and everybody else listening knows. When there's not restrictions on corporations or companies even, but certainly the big corporations, they will do anything, including working 8-year-olds in their plant, sell adulterated food, force people to work 60 hours a week, have no minimum wage, no vacations, no pension, no medical, no nothing. So, because you know what it is, and Jason, if you have a plan of the magnitude that was necessary for this, and there might not even been one possible, some people have said, it would cost them money. So they figured, it probably won't go wrong.
Right, right.
And it's gone horribly wrong, of course.
Yeah, pretty sad.
That's why
it's awful.
I wonder these right wingers who keep saying there shouldn't be, you know, the corporations are regulated too much. Do they still say this? Do they really think that there should be less regulation on these people that have our health and safety and economy in the palm of their hands, that they can wreck our lives economically, whether we're talking about being here in Michigan or here on the Gulf Coast, and they shouldn't have any regulations? We're regulated like hell. We are the ones that are regulated by the market, if you think about that. They aren't. They do what the hell they want. They're this, these enormous monopolies that control essentially the planet's finances, and the market says, oh, okay, Jason or Peter or Jolene, you know, we just don't have a job anymore. Bye. You're out of here, dudes. You know? All right, Jason, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Look, we're going to take a quick break, but there are phone lines available. Talk about the raid in Israel, and it looks like something even more dangerous is shaping up. Iran says it will escort ships to block through the blockade. Whoa.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Yes. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. If you'd like to reach us, 313-298-WRIF. We still didn't... Was that the old...
Yes, that needs to go.
Jade.
It needs to go.
It needs to go. It cannot stay.
And what we're talking about is that recorded piece does not say...
Jolene Jordan.
Yeah. I am here.
Yeah.
Do not silence me.
I think we have the wrong numbers for her.
Oh, maybe we do.
Yeah.
I'll do a little investigating.
Okay. All right. Read that email, though.
Brian from Windsor, who's a regular listener of the show. I thought Elton John was gay, or did the sight of Rush Limbaugh turn him off guys forever? That one knew it.
Yeah.
Also, isn't Rush Limbaugh supposed to be moving to Costa Rica?
He said he would, didn't he? If the health bill passed,
right?
Did I say something really weird?
You did.
I think I said health bear.
You did. I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that means. That's very weird. All right, let's hear. I said that things seem to be heating up with this deal with
Israel,
although I...
And the activists.
Yeah, although I seem to have totally lost the peace. But the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, says it will accompany... the next... Oh, man, this is terrible if I can't find this. Because it had this incredible... Man, it's not over there with you?
No.
Are we on the air?
We are.
Oh, okay. Well, then we... never mind. You can't go through it. All right. Because now this is...
Well, Iran's getting involved.
Iran says, yeah, but it's more than that, because the article at the end, it said it may, and I think that probably the Iranians were just being provocative the way they can and make wild statements. But what was... Oh, here. Yeah. This is from the newspaper, The Guardian of England, and it says, Gaza blockade, Iran offers escort to next aid convoy. Aid threatens use of Revolutionary Guard. Netanyahu warns of Jerusalem missile danger. And I wrote on here, not big story. Iran has warned that it could send Revolutionary Guard naval units to escort humanitarian aid convoys seeking to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, a move that would certainly be challenged by Israel, do you think? But here's the big story. Big story is the last two paragraphs. Israel's no compromise attitude to aid to aid convoys, to the convoys that are bringing aid, could be tested again after two Lebanese organizations pledged to send boats to Gaza in the next few days. Reporters Without Borders is attempting to assemble 25 European activists and 50 journalists for a boat leaving Beirut. The Free Palestine Movement is planning a similar attempt. Now, George Galloway, who was a former member of parliament in England, the founder of Viva Palestina, announced in London that two simultaneous convoys, one by land via Egypt and the other by sea, would set out in September to break the Gaza blockade. The sea convoy of up to 60 ships will travel the Mediterranean, gathering ships, cargo, and volunteers.
Oh.
And, I mean, if the Israelis are able, are willing to do what they already, you know, what they did, I mean, who in the world knows what could occur? You know, people think, oh, man, those activists were, you know, just confronting the Israelis. This is just like what happened in 1947. There was this ship called the Exodus, and it was bringing in... passengers that were all 4,500 men, women, and children who were Holocaust survivors, and they were trying to get to Palestine, which then was controlled by Britain. So and Britain didn't want them to come in there. So here, this is from the New York Times. The refugees. This is in 1947. These are Jewish refugees that had survived the Holocaust. Britain is saying you can't come in. The Jews get this ship together, and they try to break the blockade. This is all sounding familiar. The refugees had no legal authority to enter Palestine. And the British were determined to block the ship. In the battle that ensued, three Jews aboard the Exodus were killed. The ship's passengers, more than 4,500 men, women, and children, were ultimately deported to Germany. This is after the war. So, I mean, the attack and its aftermath, which focused attention on the plight of many European Jews after the war, made headlines worldwide and helped marshal support for an Israeli state. Let's see. The captain tried to break through two British destroyers rammed the ship. Several hours of fighting followed. This is 1947, folks. This isn't May 31st of this year. With the ship's passengers spraying fuel oil and throwing smoke bombs, life rafts, and whatever came to hand down on the British sailors trying to board. The Times reported at the time, the New York Times. Soon, the British opened fire.
Yep.
Two immigrants and a crewman on the Exodus were killed. Scores more were wounded, many seriously. The ship was towed to Haifa, and from there its passengers were deported first to France and eventually to Germany, where they were placed in camps near Lübeck. So, and then what happened is large protests erupted on both sides of the Atlantic. The ensuing public embarrassment for Britain played a significant role in the diplomatic swing of sympathy towards the Jews and the eventual recognition of a Jewish state in 1948. So, you know, the shoe's on the other foot. Same thing is that in order to drive the British out of Palestine in the 1940s, Jewish groups began terrorist bombings, blew up a hotel with a tremendous loss of life, all sorts of military attacks on both Arabs and British as well, including civilians. So when they did it, it was okay. Now it's not so good. Increasingly, the information comes out that the Gaza flotilla activists were shot in the head at close range, and including that the protesters say Israel had an assassination list that was found. I mean, Israel confiscated all of the film that everyone had, edited to its own purposes. And one of the things I thought was interesting, well, for one thing, Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law in Champaign, says the Israeli attack on the Gaza flotilla violated the Convention for the Suppression of Unlawful Acts Against Safety of Maritime Navigation, to which Israel, Turkey, Ireland, the USA are all parties. The convention was pushed by the USA in reaction to the Achille Lauro hijacking, the murder of Leon Klinghoffer, if anybody remembers that. But anyway, boarding a ship like that is in international waters. I mean, there's just, I guess, got piece after piece in that. In fact, some of these people were just in Livonia last night. There was this big Ambassador Edward L. Peck, who was Peck was chief of mission in Iraq and Mauritanian and deputy director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration. He said, what the Israelis are claiming is laughable. The passengers were defending the ships. The Israelis were attacking them, not the other way around. The Israeli spokespeople keep referring to their soldiers having paint guns as if they didn't pose a real threat, but they also had automatic weapons and stun grenades and pepper spray and tasers. They were boarding the ship. These are like acts of pirates. I mean, whatever you may think, that nobody has the right to enter a ship in international waters. These people did not want to go where this armed invasion on their ship took place. But increasingly, it looks like the shooting began from the helicopters, and that the autopsy shows that some of the people killed on the ship by the Israelis were shot at through the top of their heads. And also, I think the most telling was, if I could put this all in order, is that that the nine Turkish men on board the Mavi Marmara were shot a total of 30 times, many of them at close range, and some in the back of the head, others, two men were shot four times, five of the victims were shot either in the back of the head or back, yeah, the back of the head or in the back.
It's amazing to me that there's still now more ships that are going to be going back there, including an Irish aid ship.
Yeah. Well, the one Irish ship, the Rachel Corey, which was named after this young peace activist who was purposely run over by an Israeli army bulldozer,
right,
who was defending a Palestinian house. I mean, one of the many, many illegal things that the Israelis do in the occupied territories is they have collective punishment. In other words, that when they were suicide bombers, the family's home would be bulldozed. And to the point where there's a group called the Israeli Coalition Against Housing Demolition. These are made up of Israelis. And Jeff Halpern, who is an incredible man. And because many, many Israelis are just horrified by what their government does. I mean, it's like here.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, many of us are horrified by what our government does. But Jeff Halpern's group, the Israeli Committee, I guess it is, Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolition, which is ICAHD.org, there's a whole group set up in order to rebuild the homes that have been destroyed by the Israeli army. Again, this is violates international law.
Yeah, she was, Rachel Corey was only 21 years old, I believe, or 19, or she was young.
Yeah.
And she stood with her arms up yelling, don't, please don't, and, you know, that guy just mowed right over her.
Yeah, we interviewed her parents, remember?
We did. It was very, very, very sad.
Also, there was, I don't know if you remember, Adam Shapiro and Hawetta Araf, who is from this area, his wife.
They were on one of the
Yeah, well, yeah, they both were. Adam Shapiro, he's from New York. Hawaida is from Dearborn. He said CNN is looping footage of mayhem on one of the ships, but not giving the context that the Israelis had killed someone already at that point. The ship was in international waters. There was no plausible rationale to take it over by the Israelis. The ships were not going to Israel. They were going to Gaza. They had no plans to enter Israeli waters. All this could have been avoided if Israel had let the ships deliver their aid to Gaza. Hawaida said that that she was knocked around, and then when they finally held all these people incommunicado in a miserable Israeli prison, had them handcuffed, many cases for 24 hours, wouldn't let them go to the bathroom, and yeah. You can imagine what happened, which was purposeful. Oh, this is what this is what the Italian fascists used to do. They used to create these circumstances where people would soil themselves to humiliate their prisoners. And on the way out, a guard elbowed Hawaida in the face.
Really?
And they asked an Israeli spokesperson about that. And he said, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So she was lying.
I'm sure, yeah.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Let's go back to our phones. Here's Tina in Shelby Township. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm not trying to be too opinionated, but I really feel in my heart that that oil spill was done purposely.
Right.
I really do. You know, the reason why I say that is because if our president was truly on the ball, he would have done something by now.
But one thing doesn't follow from the other. I mean,
exactly. You know, and the thing is, that's really confusing to me is that why would they go ahead and just go ahead and have them take care of the oil, you know, themselves, when our president knows that these are our waters.
Yeah.
These are our wildlife being destroyed. He should have more pride in doing a good job.
What do you think he could have done, though? I mean, the United States government, of all of the resources it has, one of them isn't disaster management for, the oil rigs that are thousands and thousands of feet below the surface. I mean, not sure what he could have done. You know, I'll tell you, Tina, all of a sudden this is reminding me of something these kind of whack job right-wing talk show hosts say that this was done purposely in order to give oil drilling a bad name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, wouldn't it be smart if Exxon, since they've been in business for how many years, all the experience and credibility, you know, Obama should have hired them to clean it up and send BP the bill and tell them if you have so many days to pick up.
Well, I don't know, Tina. I just don't know how many.
Exxon didn't. It took a long time for them to.
I mean, when they with that oil spill the ship, the Exxon Valdez. I don't know, Tina. Conspiracy theories usually don't lead to. Too far. I mean, there's lots of them around, and to imagine. One of the problems with conspiracies. I mean, there are people that sit down and plan stuff, but some of the bigger stuff I don't buy because something of that magnitude would have to include so many people at so many different levels, and the idea that a crime of that magnitude could be carried out by somebody for who doesn't want oil drilling. I mean, he just said okay to oil drilling to the consternation of environmentalists who aren't very happy with the man. But let's see what other people have to say about it. Thanks for being a first-time caller. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number. And let's see. Here's Rob in Rochester. Hey, Rob, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome. Are you with us? No? Why don't I? Sorry, Rob. There you go, Rob. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Awesome. Well, you know, since we're talking this oil spill here, I'd like to, in the future, hear a little bit of pro-Republican opinions on this issue. I've been listening tonight and haven't heard many pro-Republican ideas. And
oh, they call in. Well, we're not pro-Republican, so you're not going to get those from this show.
We say it's a dirty job, Rob, so it's not one we want to take on. If you want to take it on, feel free. What are the Republican ideas?
Well,
I don't think they have any.
I don't think anyone has a crystal ball or has the ideal solution, but I just don't feel that that Obama is up to the task right now. I think he's too concerned and single-track minded on our country's health care issue. And
they're not even talking about it anymore.
Health care is that's old biz. Come on, I mean, what do you think he should be doing?
Well, I think that he could be pulling some money together, amongst different countries. This is a global issue. We could actually be extincting maybe even 10 to 50 species a day.
Yeah, it's BP's fault. They have how much money do they have, Peter?
They've got more money than a lot of countries. What's at issue here, Rob, is not money, and it's not even the will. I'm sure that BP would love nothing better than to end this as soon as they can. I mean, they're losing billions, and their public face, which they deserve to get a black an eye as possible, because they're a horrible country. Company. And they, their safety record is abominable. I mean, this is not the first accident that they've had. They've had refinery explosions, lots of stuff. They're always cutting corners on safety. And this goes back primarily to the George Bush administration, when he put in people that were connected to the industry into supervisory and regulatory roles. Do we want to move on to the Obama administration and say that? That he wasn't as forceful as he should have been in really grabbing them by the butt and making sure that something like this didn't occur? Yeah, but this is so ingrained this technology is so ingrained in every part of a society's existence that taking this on is a task beyond, I think, the imagination. But anyway, I don't think Republicans have any ideas, and if Republicans want to call in and say, yeah, here's my idea, I'm all for it.
I think I
appreciate it. Thank you very much.
A lot of Republicans are bitter because that's what people said about Bush when it was New Orleans, when that happened. But that was a natural disaster. This is a corporate disaster.
Yeah. Well, the Bush had no awareness. I mean, they're saying, that people saying, I want to see some fury on the part of Obama.
I think he's pretty furious.
And, well, I don't know whether I don't even know what that means. I wouldn't say...
I don't think he's happy.
Well, no, I wouldn't. I'm not furious about it. I'm just... I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, sad beyond belief.
Yes.
But also what I said earlier about the realization that this should be a wake-up call, that we've got to get off fossil fuels, that these corporations can't be trusted, that corporations are run by greed and have to be heavily, heavily regulated, or they'll always do the wrong thing. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Let's take our next caller, which is right here. This is Nick in Rochester Hills. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Peter, Julian.
Hi. Hi.
Cool. Saying about Israel, they're absolutely out of control. After hearing about them attacking an aid ship, and last December, I don't know if you remember a story running where they're actually harvesting organs from dead Palestinians without telling families. And really what's going on there in Gaza, it's like a modern-day apartheid. And if anyone remembers anything about that, we know how horrible that was. So I don't understand why
Well,
Israel...
I'd like to see this story on harvesting the organs.
It was on MSNBC. If you just go on MSNBC.com, it says Israel harvested organs in the 90s without consent.
All right. Well, Jalene will do that. I don't know if she should go to MSNBC and do that. All right, Nick, thank you very much. Hey, before this hour is over, though, I wanted to remind people again about the United States Social Forum. This is an enormous gathering of 20,000. I was going to say, it says here, Detroit to host 20,000 activists. And someone said to me, well, how are the police relating to this? You know, you can have hundreds and thousands of righties and, you know, nothing ever happens. You get a few people from the left together and they start treating you like the enemy. But Detroit is more than welcoming 20,000 people. They're talking about millions of dollars that are being, they're going to be
brought into
the local economy. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that besides the fact that we were talking earlier about Ferndale had a gay pride celebration today, Sunday, besides having an openly gay mayor in Ferndale, that that also this is like this big economic boost. I mean, people, any kind of huge
gathering or convention.
Absolutely. So the United States Social Forum is going to take place in June 22nd to 26th. It's going to be Cobo Hall and Hart Plaza. It's going to be tons of music and theater. There's going to be people from all over the country. There's people marching to Detroit from faraway towns, people riding bicycles from faraway cities. There's going to be a lot of stuff about urban agriculture, about every issue that confronts this country. And people that are going to try to figure out some solutions beyond the elites. I mean, it kills me that these righties are saying, oh, we got these bad elites in. We want our elites in because they can solve, well, they can't solve all of our problems, but at least they look like us. Yeah, man, are they yesterday's newspaper? But anyway. It's Ground Zero here, says Maureen Taylor, who actually, I know Maureen, who is a United States Social Forum staff organizer, and she says Detroit is ground zero for the economic crisis facing millions of people, not only here in Michigan, but across the nation. We are really pleased to host this historic event, and we're sure what happens in Detroit will have a huge impact, not only here, but elsewhere. A lot of unions are on board for this, but also just ordinary people are welcome to come. So I hope a lot of you make it. At least check it out. You can go to my website. It's right up on top. Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And that'll give you all the information. Either that, what I always say. I mean, our other option is what? I always say, thatch our roofs.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you dig tigers, lions, or flying octopi, it's the place. If you dig gnocchi, crepes, pulled pork, saganaki, or world-famous conies, it's the place. If you dig works of art 2,000 years old or 30 stories high, it's the place. If you dig jazz, hip-hop, classical, or indie rock, concerts inside an art museum, under the stars, or above a bowling alley, Greek neighborhoods, Irish neighborhoods, or Russian puppet theater, lunch in the park or dinner 72 stories up, the works of Diego, Smokey, Monet, or Maglio. Exploring by foot, car, boat, Segway, or rickshaw taxi. Biking the river walk or riding a carousel by the river. It's the place. The place is downtown Detroit. The address is digdowntown.com. Discover the hidden gems of downtown, midtown, Corktown, Eastern Market, and New Center. Start digging at digdowntown.com.
To hell and back. Detroit's premier celebration of bikes, bass, and rock and roll. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2010. Presented by 101 WRIF. June 19th at Northville Community Park. Join in on the party with The Riff. Broadcasting live starting at 10 a.m. Rock out with live music all day. Check out the Vendor Village. Enjoy plenty of food and drink. Feast your eyes on some of Detroit's hottest chrome with Best of Bike Show. And more. Plus, don't miss out on the charity ride. Police escorted from Motor City Harley-Davidson to the Harley Fest site. Proceeds benefit the Rainbow Connection. Get all the details at WRIF.com. June 19th at Northville Community Park. 5 Mile and Beck Road in Northville Township. Harley Fest 2010. Presented by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. From 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishes, dishwasher and break down your washing machine. Limescale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I want to hit the big wheel out there!
You're listening to Night Call, the U.S. award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. It's almost Monday, isn't it? Here in this time zone, I don't know where you're listening, but welcome to all of you across the world. If you're listening to the stream or later on today, well, today in 30 seconds, Monday at noon to the podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast at WRIF.com. Also, we're on Facebook, which is Facebook.com/nightcall. Facebook friends wanted. Always. Now, here's the story. Let me set this up because you go, wow, man, this is, you know, this is not entertainment radio. I mean, this is WRIF's public affairs.
It's informative.
Program. So it's supposed to be informative.
Hey, but we entertained.
Well, I hope so.
Come on.
Now, this one, the people say, well, man, I'm going to go get another beer or whatever when I read the German president quits over remarks on military.
Norrisville.
All right, but here, this affects all of us. President Horst Köhler of Germany resigned on Monday amid a barrage of criticism for remarks he made during a visit to Afghanistan. Mr. Köhler set off the criticism when he said in an interview with Deutschland Radio, the public broadcasting station, that German soldiers serving in Afghanistan or with other peacekeeping missions were deployed to protect German economic interests. In the radio interview, who was a former director of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and some of you are saying, IMF, well, we kind of, yeah, hey, IMF, we don't want to go there, but it's important to know who these people are. He said, a country of our size, with its focus on exports and thus reliance on foreign trade, must be aware that military deployments are necessary in an emergency to protect our interests, for example, when it comes to trade routes, for example, when it comes to preventing regional instabilities that could negatively influence our trade, jobs, and income. And so he said he had to get out of there for telling the truth, essentially. Now, that's not exactly why the United States is there. It's part of it. I mean, it is about trying to create a U.S. economic presence there, getting pipelines, you know, natural gas pipelines and all that. But part of it is that the military-industrial complex, which is the key component of our economic system, has to be fed. Doesn't matter whether wars go on forever. It doesn't matter whether we win or lose them. Doesn't matter how many people get killed, either on our side or on their side. It just means that the war and the rationale for war has to continue. So, and to some extent, it's not a war for oil. It's not a war for pipelines. It's not a war for trade. It's a war for war. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a warfare state. Well, we're saying we don't want a welfare state. Well, we have a warfare state, which really is a welfare state, because there's this great transfer of wealth from you and me to the government, which then hands it out by the trillions to companies that benefit from it. Well, doesn't it create jobs? Well, some, and they're, you know, it's an industry, so there are people that are benefiting from it, but mostly it's capital intensive, it's not labor intensive. The war in Afghanistan has reached a new milestone. It's the longest war in U.S. history. It surpasses the Vietnam War. In the meantime, I would say probably until I mentioned this, how many times did you think about the war in Afghanistan today? I mean, I didn't until I started doing stuff for this. Joe Comerford, who I have interviewed from the National Priorities Project. Over the weekend, the National Priorities Project cost of war counter designed to count the total money appropriated for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars passed the $1 trillion mark. Taxpayers in Natick, Massachusetts, this is in the one little town in western Mass, or I don't even know what part of the state it's in, have paid $206 million for total Iraq and Afghanistan war spending since 2001, she says. For that amount, instead of implementing a proposed 4% cut for Natick's libraries in 2011, the town could have doubled its total library budget. To date, $747 billion have been appropriated for the U.S. war in Iraq, $300 billion for the war in Afghanistan. The pending supplemental making its way through Congress will add an estimated $37 billion for the current $136 billion total spending for the fiscal year ending on the 30th. So you're going, so what? Somewhere I had here that they're talking about the combined shortfall of local and state budgets, and it's up around $150 billion. So, wow. 10 times of that has already gone down the drain for these wars that this war criminal, George Bush, who lied about the reason to get into Iraq, says, oh, he'd do it again. Yeah, what the hell?
Yep.
Nothing happened to him. He's just up giving speeches probably for about $20,000 or $30,000 from the Grand Rapids Economic Club.
Yep.
I'd do it again. I'd waterboard old Sheikh Mohammed as well. What the hell?
We're glad you can't.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah. So, and, got to stop those. Who are we stopping in Afghanistan? Well, the Taliban are an implacable enemy, and we're willing to spend money to stop the Taliban, except, here's what's going on here. Afghan guards suspected of colluding with insurgents. This in the New York Times today. Pardon me. For months, reports have abounded here that Afghan mercenaries who escort American and other NATO convoys through the Badlands have been bribing Taliban insurgents to let them pass. You get the deal, so they say, okay, we're going to protect these convoys, and how do they protect it? They get paid through our tax dollars. We give them the money, and then they bribe the Taliban. Okay, let them go through. After a pair of bloody confrontations with Afghan civilians, two of the biggest private security companies were banned from escorting NATO convoys on the highway between Kabul and Kandahar. The ban took effect on May 14th, the same day a NATO supply convoy rolling through the area came under attack. An Afghan driver and a soldier were killed. A truck was overturned and burned. Within 2 weeks, more than 1,000 trucks were sitting stalled in the highway, and the Afghan government granted the two companies permission to resume. That one of them is named Watan Risk Management. And Watan's president, Rashid Popal, strongly denied any suggestion that his men either colluded with insurgents or orchestrated attacks to emphasize the need for their services. But the episode and others like it have raised the suspicions of investigators here and in Washington who are trying to track, ready, tens of millions of taxpayer dollars paid to private security companies to move supplies to American and other NATO bases. So while our cities are closing our libraries, are cutting back on police and fire, tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer dollars are paid to private security companies that are doing what? Although the investigation is not complete, the officials suspect that at least some of these security companies, many of which have ties to top Afghan officials, are using American money to bribe the Taliban. So we're funding the Taliban. That's where our money's going. The officials suspect the security companies may also engage in fake fighting to increase the sense of risk on the roads, and that they may sometimes stage attacks against competitors. A NATO official in Kabul said, "We're funding both sides of the war." The official who spoke on the condition of anonymity, that's interesting. Anonymity, because the investigation was incomplete, said he believed millions of dollars were making their way to the Taliban.
Yep.
Millions of dollars, that's our dollars. Look at your paycheck, think how much of it went to the Taliban. It's a racket, folks. We're being ruled by rackets. And what do? I mean, we'll go into the United States Social Forum this June 22nd to 26th to end it all the next day? I don't think so. But there's two aspects. One, we can have a movement of the people to end this racket called government and corporations. Or we can just continue on like we are. Just hope that the Wheel of Misfortune doesn't come up with our number on it. Those are, I would say, the two options that we have. You listen to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. Let's go back to some people that have been waiting patiently. Here's Dylan in Macomb. Dylan, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Welcome to WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, just a couple minutes ago, you had a caller who was talking about a conspiracy that the oil spill in the Gulf was caused on purpose and stuff, and it reminded me of another conspiracy theory bit that I wanted to share.
Sure.
The Kennedy assassination is supposed to be a conspiracy theory, and when his body was brought in, they removed his brain and
right.
brought it to the Library of Congress, who subsequently lost it.
That's right.
They lost the president's brain.
I didn't know this.
I can't remember whether they ever found it. Did they ever find it again?
I don't know.
Who's got his brain?
Yeah. So what do you think? Do you think, I'm always curious about this, do you think Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy or a lone assassin?
I don't really care.
Well, you know what? It's getting to the
That's
point.
That's funny.
Let me see. I don't even think I can do the math. Seven would be seven. So it was almost 50 years ago. So it's sort of like asking anybody under 55, do you think that there was a conspiracy to kill Lincoln? Which some people think that it went, well, there was, but, yeah. So, yeah. And sometimes on November 22nd, I ask people to say, who do they think killed Kennedy? Oswald, the CIA, the Soviets, the Cubans, the mob? Or I don't care.
I have no idea. That's my answer.
Most people think the CIA. But, Dylan, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Chris. Chris is in Howell. Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Man, I have been waiting so long.
Welcome.
Welcome, Jolene.
Jolene, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been smoking reefer? Let me ask you a question. Have you been smoking weed tonight?
A little bit earlier.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. So that's why it seemed like such a long time.
I've been drinking beer, too.
Yeah.
Okay, what you got for me?
Little Crown Royal, too.
Okay, yeah. So you're going to make a lot of sense and real clear-minded with your... What do you got?
No, I'm clear-minded, Jolene.
Okay.
What's your partner's name?
Peter Werby.
So it's Peter and Jolene.
Peter and Jolene. Yeah, you got it.
All right. You made a comment way earlier in the show about a gentleman that you jumped all over his stuff.
Yeah.
Because he made a comment about something that you didn't appreciate.
No, it's a racist term.
No.
Yeah.
It is a racist term.
Yeah.
And you felt threatened because he thought he could speak his mind because he had an African-American girlfriend.
Yeah. I didn't feel threatened.
I didn't feel threatened
at all. I was upset. I was offended.
Well, what offends me, Chris, what we were saying is sometimes people think because you're just like them, like, you know, if I'm like a white male, they think that they can say any kind of stupid, racist, homophobic, anti-Arab, you know, stuff like that. All right. Thank you for your call. Appreciate your summary. here's Maurice in Detroit. Go ahead, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter, Jillian. How you doing?
Maurice.
We're doing good.
No, it's enough is enough with this war. No, the soldiers got to go on strike, lay the weapons down. We don't need all these bases around the world. Don't shoot nobody. They won't shoot at you.
Raids and things like that?
Yeah.
Just stop fighting, you know? You know, we're killing people. Our society's going to hell.
You know, I was just listening. If you go on your computer and you Google George Carlin, he's talking a whole thing about war.
Yeah.
In fact, George Carlin, I would love to be replaced. I mean, he's passed, of course, but be replaced by George Carlin. Maybe I should just play George Carlin clips.
Yes.
They own you is great. Hey, Maurice, you've called this show for years. You're impassioned. Are you going to head down to the U.S. Social Forum down at Cobo Hall on June 22nd and 26th? Did you just make a rude noise?
No, he's opening his door.
I can make that because I'm off that day.
Come on down, yeah. Yeah, and Maurice, I have to say, just once again, you know, you've called for a lot of years, and your cell phone reception or whatever has always been a little iffy. Sounding crystal clear.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go that far, but maybe I think that noise was his truck backing up.
I think
all
so.
Right, Maurice, thank you very much. Appreciate it. See you downtown, Cobo Hall.
And hang up and drive.
Yeah. There is, by the way, I mean, there is, when you register for the United States Social Forum, and you can do it at my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. You can't register at my website. You can click to the link, or you can go to USSF2010.org. This is a big thing to put on, so you got to. I don't know what the fees are, but there's a lot of stuff that's at Hart Plaza that you can hear for free. There could be a lot of music and what have you. Isn't David Rovics coming in to play? One of our favorite folk singers.
He is.
Yeah, that's good. Here's Jeff in Marine City. Jeff, hi. How you doing? You're on.
Hey. You remember, you guys were talking about the power and everything, the windmills earlier.
Yeah.
I have to go back because I've been on hold for over. Well, you know, like, how come they can't have, I live right on the Clear River, how come they can't have hydroelectric power instead of burning coal? And also on the Detroit River, how come they can't have hydroelectric power? You know, just like the Hoover Dam or something.
Well, you know what? I think that it has to go, that the not the volume, but there has to be more volume of water, and it has to be the velocity, the speed. I mean, the St. Clair River.
Oh, the current is real strong.
It's like 6 miles an hour, isn't it? Or three miles an hour
it goes. It's strong. But, I mean...
Well, I know. Listen, if you jump... I mean, I've kayaked in the Detroit River, and you crank along. And once or twice, other than Belle Isle, where the current doesn't really hit where you swim, but I've jumped in... I'm trying to think where that was. Some marina, and boom, you start going downstream pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's not... in fact, Jeff, I am sure that it's not strong enough to turn turbines.
I bet it is, but, you know, well, if they put a dam up, it would be...
Okay, well, a dam. You got to. Where would you put a dam? You got to have, you know, some fall. But I'll tell you what. As you can't argue, we can't argue about facts. So the technologically minded, they can. Me, I'm technologically challenged. Give a call 313-298-WRIF. I say that the rivers are not sufficient. Don't have enough speed to turn turbines for hydroelectric
power.
Someone
needs to invent something to make it happen.
Maybe someone could. Maybe it is there. All right, Jeff, that's a good suggestion. Thank you. Appreciate your call. You know, I did want to. Rather than two things in a row, I'm going to talk. I don't know for sure. I'll go on to this. Our friend, Captain Paul Watson, who has been...
You've probably seen him on Whale Wars.
Yeah, I was going to say, the season premiered on Friday, Whale Wars, and they're going to have how many? A 12-part series. Now, this is an incredible one. The Operation Waltzing Matilda, as it was called, in honor of Australia's official national anthem, there was a 3-month journey to the South Ocean Whale Sanctuary to stop Japan's illegal whaling, and this conflict between a sea shepherd and the Japanese whaler just grew more intense with each engagement, to the point where finally one of the Japanese ships sank one of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ships. In fact, it was this one. You know, we gave the information, but I can't remember the name of the ship or too many of the details. It was one of the fastest ships in the world. It was a little small one.
Yep.
And something that held the record for circumnavigation and it got sunk. It actually got sunk.
Was Captain Paul on that one?
No, he was on the bigger ship, which is where
these people are tough as nails, aren't they?
They have one called the Bob Barker. You know, Bob Barker from...
Oh, yeah.
Where is he from, Jeopardy? Or from...
No, he had The Price is Right.
The Price is Right, right.
He's a ladies' man. But, remember that?
No.
Yeah, he always harassed all of his model babes. He got sued by a bunch of them.
Really?
But at least he loves the animals.
Yeah. I got to say, I never saw it ever. But, he's on a boat called the Steve Irwin, off the coast of North Africa, getting ready to kick off Operation Blue Rage. I think they're trying to save tuna. And one of their captains is taking on corruption in the Galapagos Islands. Captain Pete Bethune is publicizing the illegal whale slaughter in Japan. Now, Pete Bethune was the captain of the ship that got sunk by the Japanese, and he has a trial going on. They arrested him for piracy on the high seas because what they're doing, the sea shepherds, are interfering with the whaling, and they cut.
Which is illegal, right?
Well, it is. It is indeed. Now, we were talking earlier about Obama, and he's now under fire for backing a deal that would lift the global ban on commercial whaling.
Oh, my gosh.
He says, and he didn't like it. I mean, one of his campaign promises was that he would be on board to completely abolish all whaling. But let me see. Under Obama's deal, the three whaling countries, which are, Japan, Norway, and Iceland, would be allowed to keep hunting whales for a 10-year period in reduced numbers. The whaling countries, in return, would agree to tighter oversight of their operations, including participation in a whale DNA registry. Now, the supporters of that say, we recognize that these measures do not meet the needs of those who want a complete end to whaling now, but neither can it be characterized as a whaler's charter. We believe that it is undeniably better than the status quo. The environmentalists, including Patrick Ramage, the whaling director at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, said the moratorium on commercial whaling was the greatest conservation victory of the 20th century, and in 2010, to be waving the white flag or bowing to the stubbornness of the last three countries engaged in the practice is mind-numbingly dumb ideas. So, I mean, what the U.S. Navy ought to do is just go down there and say, hey, we don't need Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
We'll stop them.
We'll stop them, yeah. Yeah. So it's this is a disappointment in the Obama administration. Meanwhile, a colleague of Peter Bethune, the Animal Planet star, awaiting trial in Tokyo after a collision between his anti-whaling boat and a Japanese ship, says the environmental activist is doing what the international community refuses to do, save the whales. Okay.
There they go, talking about saving the whales again.
There they go. All right. Here is Jeremiah from Redford. Do you have information on hydroelectric stuff?
Yeah, the use of hydroelectric as a form of energy source has been around forever, as we all know.
Sure.
Beyond that, recently on the TV, I viewed some of the more technically minded shows, and they were talking about the use of a hydroelectric screw that's placed inside the current underneath the water.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, when the flow of water goes through that, it turns the screw for it. And therefore, I believe it doesn't take as much of a current or a backlog of water like in a dam system.
So there are things.
So you think that the river would work?
Oh, I believe it would. I don't know the technical aspects of it, but I do know that less power would be needed to generate the screw movement, because then the entire force of the water is flowing over the entire screw itself.
Sure. And during the winter, I guess it's still flowing underneath, isn't it?
It would still be flowing underneath the water, or underneath the ice, yes.
Okay, well, I'm sort of surprised that no one, given our proximity to all this water, that no one has ever attempted this before.
If I'm not mistaken, they have it in use on the East Coast, either Boston or New York, in the harbor systems.
Really?
It could be anything from environmentalists stopping it for whatever reason, or just the cost of application could stop it as well. I'm not, incredibly versed.
Yeah, maybe it chews up fish.
Maybe that's the issue.
Yeah. Well, there won't be any fish.
Hey, if it could only target those muscles, we'd be all set.
There you go. All right. Bye-bye. What muscles? Those zebra muscles?
Yes.
Jade writes, and the Gile is the name of the boat. Doesn't strike me like the one that the Sea Shepherd boat that got sunk by the
Japanese whale. I don't remember.
Anyway, did I finish up with this?
Sounds like something they
do. So Whale Wars is absolutely incredible. I found it nail biting. I mean, here are these.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that?
I have seen portions of it. Yes.
Woo. Yeah. I mean, talk about reality TV. I mean,
intense.
Very, very, very intense. You know, I was reading. In fact, usually I talk about this stuff right at the beginning, which is economics, because again, this is not real exciting. I mean, what we should be doing is, you know, arguing about abortion or gun rights or something like that. We do something, but ultimately, those are diversions from the greater social and economic forces that are shaping our lives. And right now, we don't have any control over it whatsoever. So once in a while, I realize that some of this stuff I'm kind of faking it on, that I don't really understand what in the hell is going on. I mean,
you
try
open yourself up when you say that, Peter. You're going to get an email.
I don't care. And some people,
you already have one guy really mad at you tonight. You'll read it later.
God, you don't want to read it?
Well, I'll pull it up again.
Okay.
It's very long.
Oh, yeah, short ones, please, and we'll do it. But, for instance, do you understand M3, the money supply?
No.
No, you don't pretend to. But so I thought, I was reading about this, that they're fearful that instead of inflation, which we know, then it takes more money to buy the same product. So it means our money is actually worth less. So they're worried, though, about what they call deflationary pressures that would make the money in shorter supply. So I'm going, money supply, what the hell is this? So it's like this M3 stuff. But I want to read this because this is what I'm supposed to understand. And, you know, whatever you may think of my political opinions, I am capable of learning and repeating stuff. So I read this stuff over and over again. So it says, in economics, money supply or money stock is the total amount of money available in an economy at a particular point in time. That makes sense. They kind of add up all this, money about how much is, you know, available at different levels and sort of the different compartmentalization of the economy, and they say this is how much we have. There are several ways to define money, but the standard measures usually include currency in circulation and demand deposits. And it kind of goes on. Money supply data are recorded and published. Public and private sector analysts have long monitored change in money supply because of its possible effect on the price level, inflation, blah, blah, blah. The relation between money and prices is historically associated with the quantity theory of money. I mean, why should anybody have to understand this? I mean, for one thing.
I was glossing over.
Yeah. That was my point. So I begin to gloss over, and I mean, I understand it in kind of its general application. But the point being is there must be somewhere a failing of the people that say they understand it to apply it because they screw everything up.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So what good does it do you to know all this? And part of the deal is that an economy should be simple. It ought to be easily understood by the average person, and to the point that I don't understand this fully. Lots of you don't understand it at all. But you know, you do. You really do. Either you or some of you are younger, your parents or whatever, you go to work and you're paid for your labor. Mm-hmm. That's pretty understandable. And then you take your money and you go buy an orange or a shirt or something mm-hmm. like that. And the person that owns that, they buy more stock, but then they buy their own oranges. So that's all pretty simple. That's all pretty simple. Why in the world should it have to be as intricate and complex? Why are there people that, I forgot the what do they call these guys, that are actually buying and selling money?
Oh, right, yeah.
I mean, money is like an equivalent, or it's a measure of value, right? Because if you think about it, what is $5? Huh?
I have a hard time grasping the money-buying money thing.
I mean, when you really think about it, or, you know, the gold nuts, the money nuts who think that everything ought to be backed by gold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had a few calls recently that.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's not enough, we've said before, it's not enough gold in the world to be the basis for enough of the economy. Anyway, so part of the problem is that it's all too complex, and that the people that run things, the people that own us, to quote George Carlin, have created a system that is out of our control, and actually, I think, probably are out of their control as well. Although, they look pretty self-confident when you see them on television. You know, they've got their
suit
fancy
their
suits.
Yeah.
here in the New York Times, it says Europe's woes, you know, all Greece and all that, are only one of the several risks still facing the American economy. The biggest danger is high and intractable unemployment, currently almost 10%. Actually, it went down the other day. This is from when? Oh, this is from May 29th. We weren't here last week. Or 15.3 million people, nearly half of who have been jobless for more than 6 months. At the same time, this is where it was. At the same time, state budgets are collapsing, with governments facing a collective budget hole of $112 billion in the fiscal year that starts for most of them on July 1st. Closing the gaps will mean tax increases and spending cuts, which will provoke more layoffs, both among public employees and businesses that contract with state and local government. Now, I don't know. I mean, if I didn't throw everything in this messy big pile here, I might be able to get back about this cost. But this is exactly... Oh, yeah. Here. So far, here, we're talking about a measly $112 billion, which means your library is being closed. Your cops are being laid off. Your teachers are getting laid off. Your kids are going to school with 36 children in their class and what have you. That the war in Iraq that George Bush just delightfully said, oh, I would do it all over again, has cost you and me $750 billion. So that would easily cover what is happening in the local governments.
Governments, right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what it's all about. I mean, but it gets worse. This is what I was saying. Fears rise in Europe over potential for deflation. But Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize or Pulitzer Prize winning economist, one or the other, he says, what's the greatest threat to our still fragile economic recovery? Dangers abound, of course, but what I currently find most ominous is the spread of a destructive idea, the view that now, less than a year into a weak recovery from the worst slump since World War II, is the time for policymakers to stop helping the jobless and start inflicting pain. When the financial crisis first struck, he says, most of the world's policymakers responded appropriately, cutting interest rates and allowing deficits to rise. And by doing the right thing, by applying the lessons learned from the 1930s, they managed to limit the damage. It was terrible, but it wasn't a second Great Depression. So in other words, this building up of this debt now is really dangerous. On the other hand, what the alternative was much more dangerous. But, pardon me, says Paul Krugman, however, demands that governments switch from supporting their economies to punishing them have been proliferating in op-ed speeches and reports from international organizations. So what are you saying? What in the hell? What was he talking about? What's going on here? This means austerity, dear friends. This means exactly what it said in this other article here, that closing these gaps will mean tax increases and spending cuts. Tax increases will be okay if they're for the wealthy. Remember, I read all the time from Forbes that most of the richest people on the planet have seen their fortunes soar in the last year. So they're getting wealthier and wealthier. So if we need a lot more money, it's eat the rich, right? I don't even have... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here we go. A little musical interlude. Croak is saying, out of the castles into the ditch, eat the rich. Well, we're not about that, but they could certainly pay an extraordinarily higher tax rate than they are. For instance, they wouldn't be able to have a $68 million New Jersey mansion. who's the man here? Man.
$68 million?
Richard Kurtz, yeah.
Wow.
He said it's just he and his wife are going to live there, but the mansion is 5 stories tall, 12 bedrooms, 19 bathrooms, showers and views. You won't believe. 4 kitchens, an 11-car garage.
Oh, my gosh.
9 fireplaces, 20 flat-screen televisions, the wine center cellar with 3,000 bottles.
Wow.
Uses thumbprint security to get in, and on and on and on and on. I grew up.
Imagine the staff that it takes to take care of that place.
So, you know, grab off about... $67 million. Leave the guy with a paltry. I mean, we can't either that, Ian, or you pay for it. Okay. I mean, if you did, I wouldn't mind. But I mean, anybody that says, "Oh man, you can't have these confiscatory taxes," you ought to offer then your money and not have it come out of mine, right? Because I don't want to pay for these guys to have $68 million mansions while they're laying off, closing the library in my town and trying to make sure that they don't have to lay off firemen and EMT and what have you, right?
Yes.
And here also what's going on. Paychecks from private businesses have shrank to their smallest share of personal income in U.S. history during the first quarter of this year. And the recession has, this according to USA Today, the recession has erased 8 million jobs. At the same time, government provided benefits from Social Security, unemployment insurance, food stamps, and other programs rose to a record high during the first 3 months of 2010. Can you say Rome?
Yeah, really.
I mean, we're heading towards it, folks. A record low 42% of the nation's personal income came from private wages and salaries in the first quarter. 42% of us got private wages and salaries in the first quarter. I mean, it was 45%.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get this. Individuals got 18% of their income from the government programs in the first quarter. Where'd the rest come from? I don't understand.
Yeah, a little hole there.
But anyway, there is a problem here. So, with the guys that understand the M3, the money supply, that the direct relation between long-term price inflation and money supply growth that underlie the current reliance on monetary policy to meet controlling inflation. Okay. Couldn't we make it simpler? Well, they're not going to do it because, as I read and threw it into this enormous pile. That the rich are getting richer. So what's the deal? If we're getting poorer, in other words, we're going to have to face austerity. Cutbacks are the order of the day. Layoffs are what's going to happen, and they're getting richer. Anybody want to defend this? Usually you get these guys from downriver, you know, it's their money. Who are you to say that they can't make it? I mean, you're just a pig to be stuck. I mean, they depend on folks like you.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
It all starts with having a good pre-screened group of contractors to choose from. And Hire It Done is your one-stop guide to finding the one that's right for your home improvement project. Hi, I'm Adam Helfman, host of WRIF's Hire It Done. Before you start your day's home improvement tasks around your house, grab a cup of hot coffee and tune us in Saturday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join us this weekend on how to keep your home cool all hot weather season long. You won't want to miss this. Why summer is the best time to clean your vents. Arnie Goodman of American Standard Roofing sits down with us on the Contractor's Corner with your summer roof tips. And Tim Rafferty of Remax Realtors with what's really going on in the real estate market. Hire It Done Spotlight on the latest home improvement products. We'll head back to school at Hire It Done University and teach you how to avoid getting scammed. Plus, I'll take your house calls live. All this Saturday, beginning at 7 a.m. on Hire It Done and 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Hire It Done.
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, the online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy and Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Why spend more than you have to on your life insurance? Our free service can save you a fortune on your life insurance in just one short phone call. I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. At AccuQuote, we monitor hundreds of top-rated life insurance products to find you the lowest prices. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can protect his family with $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. Rates for women are even lower. We even have term life policies that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. AccuQuote makes it easy to find the best values. Just call 800-654-2075. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people save a fortune on their life insurance. How much can you save? Just call AccuQuote at 800-654-2075. Call now for your free quote. 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
101, The Riff.
101, WRIF.
The Riff.
Hi, this is Mark Shemai from Creed.
Hey, everybody, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters.
The Riff.
Hey, it's Casey.
This is Chad.
This is Chris.
This is Brian from Cabo.
And you've got it on Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Everything that rocks.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Do you know someone who always seems well-connected? Here's your chance to one-up that person and then some. Welcome to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses. Simply log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com for special online coupons and discounts you can't get anywhere else.
This week's featured deal is Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy and Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills.
All you have to do is visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. You'll save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your computer. Heck, you don't even have to get dressed. No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Shot naked, man. Yeah!
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, man. Hey, like, this chair is really cold.
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
And joining me, Jalene Jordan.
Every week.
Yeah. let's see here. There was a number of emails. That one. Thanks for the drawing. I don't know if we can share that. Yeah, William, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, says, we were talking earlier about John Lennon getting the award for, well, I don't have it in front of me, the Gershwin Concert Award, something like that.
No, it was Paul McCartney.
What did I say?
Lennon.
Oh, yeah, I don't think John Lennon's going to get it. Thank you.
Well, he could get it post.
Yeah. But anyway, it was wait a minute. Oh, I see. I'm reading here from William. John Lennon was the one who spoke out against the war and protests and took the chances. As a group, they are my favorite. Now Paul decides to make a statement at really no personal or professional risk. And what we're talking about, Sir Paul was at the White House getting this award, and he performed, and he then made a derogatory remark about George Bush.
The 8 years of hell.
Yeah, the eight years of hell.
I mean, he didn't say that. That's me.
Yeah, and... and the Republican minority leader in the Senate, in the House rather, John Boehner, said, you know, he should apologize. Williams says, my personal opinion, I think the White House should tone it down a few notches. People are suffering and many do not have the means to even care about the White House rewards or concerts. I think about who those concerts represent. Why do they always focus on people of fame and fortune? Well, I know what you're saying, but this is a nation just, infatuated by...
Celebrities. Absolutely.
Yeah, it has been for a long time, but I hear you. Let's see. There was
and it's Paul McCartney. Come on. He's now, cool.
Now, this is interesting. From Benedict at large, or maybe it's anarchist, because, you know, you make an anarchist A with the at sign. Must be at. Yeah, Benedict at large. He says, you said BP would like nothing better than to end this fiasco. This is interesting. I beg to differ, he says. It occurred to me that everything BP was trying had a single focus, keeping the hole viable. They don't seem to be willing to simply close the hole in a fashion that it cannot be reopened at a later time. So I checked into why. As it turns out, 70 $70 a barrel, at $70 a barrel, this hole is worth about $80 billion. The cleanup has just reached the billion-dollar mark, and I'm figuring about $20 billion by the time everything is paid down. But let's say it's actually twice as much. Well, obviously, the hole pays for the spill and tucks in a nice little profit for BP at the same time, but only if the hole stays viable. If it doesn't, BP has to apply for a new permit, and who the hell would be crazy enough to grant this, given that BP has proven beyond a doubt they are not capable of safely drilling in such conditions. So, okay, BP would like this media event to end as soon as possible, not if it means losing the hole permanently. In that case, the $20 or $40 billion would come straight out of the shareholders' pockets, and this jerkwad CEO would be walking the unemployment line. I like to be thought like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's certainly a consideration. You believe that these guys are thinking along those lines. Our friend and colleague, talk show host Tom Hartman, he found out all this information that the company that makes this dispersant, this poisonous dispersant that BP put on this oil a week or so, and they were ordered by the EPA not to do it, and they kept doing it.
Yeah.
That it's banned, its use is banned in Britain, where BP, British Petroleum, is from, and that the CEO of the dispersant company was on the board of directors of BP for 23 years.
This is just, it's always the same story, Peter.
Yeah, the big racket. And they being the company that, and I'm pretty sure about this one, as I remember Tom talking, Tom is scrupulous about his facts.
He sure is.
That they have never sold a quart of it, and suddenly BP just bought 700,000 gallons.
Oh, yeah. Cha-ching.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
And who cares what the cost is, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to our phones. Here's Robin Southgate. Hey, Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, how's everyone doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Great.
Okay, earlier today you guys were talking about the monetary system, which brought an interest to me. One of the comments you made is many of you might not know about it. Well, the fact of the matter is the monetary system is nothing more but the biggest scheme ever collaborated by the government. In fact, if you read your money now, it says on every dollar, if it's a dollar bill, $200 bill, it says, this note is tender for all debts, public and private.
Wow.
And what that means is that simply it's no more than a piece of paper. You see, before 1913, every bill that was printed by the U.S. said, this note is backed by gold.
Well, it said they were gold or silver certificates in the case of, like, single dollar. But so what?
So what that means is this. Before that time, it was backed by public banks owned by people such as me and yourself. Now it is backed by the central bank. For every dollar that is printed off, so say we print off a dollar, the government says, okay, we want the central bank to print off a dollar. The central bank says, okay, you produce a note. But if we print a dollar, you owe us the dollar. So therefore, how could inflation ever end?
Well, obviously inflation has gone up, forever. I mean, things that were worth, say, 100 years ago, think what they're worth today. But, a modern economy can't operate on what you're suggesting. I mean, you haven't really set it right out, but there's not enough gold in the world to back the amount of money that exists on the planet and is necessary for doing commerce. In other words, it's all just sort of based on faith. You're right. We got these pieces of paper with dead presidents on it, and I don't know about you. I don't know how your money comes to you, Rob, but my check is directly deposited. I charge almost everything I can so I can get frequent flyer miles. Then at the end of the month, I write a check. So where's my money? Do I have any money? I might not even really have any, but it all works.
So you believe. Every dollar in every person's pocket in America is a dollar owed to someone. Now, granted, yes, you have money directly deposited, but what you don't know about the system and what they don't want you to know about the system is every dollar you deposit is redeposited 10 times and makes the central bank that much more money.
Well, it's not like the central bank is creating this fortune for itself. I mean, all countries have central banks. I mean, you have to have it in a modern economy. I'm not sure I want a modern economy, but if we're going to have a country with huge finances, with industrial production, with all the rest, you can't. I mean, what are you talking about? We should go back to like a gold standard?
Exactly.
It's insane.
Got done having this conversation last hour.
Yeah, I mean, there's not enough gold around to, I mean, look at the price of gold now. I mean,
exactly. See, you make the point perfect. Did you know that 98% of the world's money exists only on computer?
Right.
And the reason for that, but do you know the reason for that? Because the gold system backed us so well that Americans were making money. Americans were. You see.
Wait. We went off the gold standard in 1933. There'd already been with a massive depression for 4 years.
Yeah, and through the depression, what did the American government said? They stated, if all American citizens do not turn in their gold, they could be held accountable. And the
that was gold coins, not gold. People could privately hold gold. I mean, you're really. I mean, I appreciate you telling us all this, but you're really beating a dead horse. I mean, we're never going back to a gold standard. You're right. 90% of of the representation of wealth is just that. It's a representation. It's not real. It's not there. If everybody said, you got to bring the money and put it on the table, a lot of people would be going, you know, if we all went to the banks and said, I mean, that's why they would have runs on banks. If every one of us said, we want the money out of the bank, we wanted all the money out of our 401ks, we want all available cash, it just wouldn't be there. And, I mean, sort of, this is not what's going to solve our problem. You know, I got to move on, Rob, but I, you know, appreciate you thinking about that. Although, hate to say it, hate to be mean, but it's what I call the money nuts. Eric in Ypsilanti. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, PW and JJ.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, E.
Hey. just to let you guys know, if we continue to give foreign aid to Israel, don't you guys think that they could be hiding or making nuclear weapons?
What do you mean? They have this huge nuclear arsenal, and they're one of the most dangerous countries in the world, probably right along with Pakistan.
Yes.
Yes. But, you know, it's if you put up to a vote, and if we... I mean, if you really voted among the people, had a plebiscite, you know, that we all got to vote. And the question was, should we continue to give military aid to Israel, Jordan, Egypt, anybody else in the Middle East that's getting it from us? Let's just say the three of them. My mind isn't...
Well, we're pals with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Hello. Thank you. Saudi Arabia. That, in other words, that there is enough. I quoted that figure a little earlier about $115 billion shortfall for local and state budgets, that we would be able to more than, well, I don't know that that it would come up to that figure, but it's billions and billions of dollars that we give to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Jordan, Egypt. And when you're counting in, for instance, that's all about oil. It's all about protecting oil. There's not another reason that we are giving this money. I mean, one of the things they do, we give them money, and then they buy armaments from us. Isn't that cute?
Yeah. It's very sweet.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. And so we're arming everybody to the teeth, and eventually someone's going to use it. I mean, that's, you know, so like all the weapons used by the Israeli, or not all of them, but a good parts of them probably were paid for by you and me in that raid on May 31st. But I don't think if we put it up to a vote, I don't think any of those countries would get a dime from us, a dime. Yet you have all of our representatives that are in on the racket. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you, Eric. Let's see. Here is Mike. Mike's in Dearborn. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Pretty good.
How are you?
not too bad at all.
Good.
I was going to talk about the comments I just heard, like, from both the previous listener and the listener before, and I'd like to say, both of you people, you know, you work an honest living, correct?
That what?
Who, us?
You both work in Honest Living.
Yes, sure. Well, I don't know. Some people don't include radio announcers in that category, but go ahead.
Well, let me ask you this. How would you feel if you knew your money was worth more than nothing?
How would I, if my
money was worth more than nothing,
well, I'd be really happy. I'd be very happy. If it was worth nothing, I would feel terrible.
Yeah.
Well, all you got to do is read your money. You see, money is this crazy corruption to where, yes, it does have a value to us as individuals,
mm-hmm.
but to the government, it has no value. It's nothing more than a piece of paper printed off. Now, inflation can never decrease, only to increase. If you look at the way America has ran, we've always ran into a depression over a certain amount of time. You look at the depression in the 1910s, look at it. Do the math, do the years, and see where we run into it again now. And why is that? It's because money is not backed by anything. Now, the last president...
Well, wait, before you just mentioned some of these depressions, recessions, bank panics, and what have you, way before they ended the gold standard. Why were we having depressions in the late 19th century and in 1910?
Because, simply for the fact that central bank became involved, printing money that owed money to it. So if you print $100 and you owe them $100, how can you ever get out of debt? You can't. It's just
I don't know. I mean, the whole idea of concern about the quality of money or the nature of money has been revolved in circles, I think, probably since the 1840s. I mean, there was depressions in the 1840s as well. It's in the nature of capitalism, my friend. There's a boom and bust. It's cycles. It's all based on this rapid expansion, overproduction, underconsumption, and it's not about the money supply. The money supply, you're right. I don't even know what when people argue what money is. I mean, I was reading this definition of it, but people argue about exactly what money is, what causes its value to fluctuate, there is the worry now. It's not about inflation. It's about deflation. Europe could go into that. Japan had deflation for a decade. So forget about the money. It's all in the nature of being dominated by these economic elites. Do they function through a central bank? Yeah, that was, when was that put in? I think it was by Andrew Jackson in the 1830s. So that's a done deal. We live in a computer world. Our wealth is little computer digits. And might it all one day just someone say the emperor has no clothes? Yep. Very possible. I hope not. All right. Thank you for bringing it up, though. Well, let's see. Is there any commercials we have? We got time for one more. Here's Daryl in Romulus. Daryl, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
You're going to bring up a subject that we haven't even touched tonight.
Well, the reason why I want to bring it up
Tell us what it is.
Umpire admitted that he made a mistake and he was wrong.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. He stood up like a man and said, hey, I was wrong and I'm sorry. Talk to the pitcher, apologize to the pitcher, which is what sportsman's all about. What I think is wrong is people calling him up and threatening him and his family. Now, I think that is right down wrong.
Really?
That's happening?
That it happened. It was on your talk show with Mike and...
Drew and Mike in the morning.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And it was mentioned on the news, which I caught on the news because I watch. The only thing I care about the news is the weather because it affects me directly because I'm outside all the time. But I think it is wrong. And it's true. The rain, the snow, the heat, everything, everything affects me. And I watch the news because of the weather.
Okay.
And I caught that, and I think it's just wrong and despicable that somebody would call up and threaten him and his family. He's scared about his family.
I just think it's ridiculous that I know this was a huge deal. I'm not discounting it at all. But a death threat? Come on.
Over sports?
Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
God.
People got nothing better to do.
That's right. True.
Thanks for being our last caller. If you're on hold, my apologies for leaving you there. Got a couple of interesting interviews following. Remember, again, United States Social Forum. It's US sf2010.org. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. We'll talk next week. Thank you, Jalene. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you, Jade.
Thank you, Jade.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, the online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy and Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
It's been to hell and back. Detroit's premier celebration of bikes, babes, and rock and roll. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2010. Presented by 101 WRIF. June 19th at Northville Community Park. Join in on the party with The Riff. Broadcasting live starting at 10 a.m. Rock out with live music all day. Check out the vendor village. Enjoy plenty of food and drink. Feast your eyes on some of Detroit's hottest chrome with Best of Bike Show. And more. Plus, don't miss out on the charity ride. Police escorted from Motor City Harley-Davidson to the Harley Fest site. Proceeds benefit the Rainbow Connection. Get all the details at WRIF.com. June 19th at Northville Community Park, 5 Mile and Beck Road in Northville Township. Harley Fest 2010, presented by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. From 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Well, this whole country is about revolution, isn't it? Oh, it's kind of a bad word for a lot of people. But that's how we began, with a big revolution. And then there's been lots of revolutions since. If you look at the Civil War, if you look at the women's rights movement, the union movement, and, of course, the civil rights movement. All of these movements, mass-based movements of the people, maybe exclude the Civil War from that, but certainly not the abolitionist movement that brought up the issue of slavery. It's been the people in motion that have made the history of this country, that have extended democracy as far as it can be, and maybe not as far as it should be or will be, but they sure gave it their best. The civil rights movement has gained iconic status. If you think about it, Martin Luther King Jr., a holiday for this man. There isn't one for the women's suffrage movement, and there isn't one for, say, Walter Reuther and the labor movement, but there is because this there is for the civil rights movement, because this was a key moment in American history. There's been a tremendous amount written about it by memoirs of people, and as it begins to fade in terms of time, talking about revolution as the revolution of time moves on, more and more is being looked at, reflected upon. A book has come my way, extraordinarily interesting. It's called The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, and it's about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was called SNCC, and some of you may have heard of it. Hopefully lots of you have. The book is written by Anthony B. Lewis, and Anthony B. Lewis has taught at the University of Richmond, Hamilton College, and Wesleyan University, and with Julian Bond, a very important figure in the civil rights movement, and also in this book. Is co-editor of Gonna Sit at the Welcome Table, a documentary history of the civil rights movement. And we welcome Andrew B. Lewis. He's at his home in Concord, Massachusetts, the home of the American Revolution. Andrew Lewis, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, there's... certainly, the more we know of history, the more we know of our origins, the more able we are to make decisions about today. There's been a tremendous amount written about the civil rights movement. What's new in your book, The Shadows of Youth?
Well, like many people, I got interested in the movement through my admiration for Martin Luther King, but the more I studied, the more I realized that it was more complex than that, and I wanted to drill down and tell a story about some of the activists of it. I always say that if King wrote the poetry of the movement, then SNCC acted out its prose, and it seemed to me that that everyday hard slog of civil rights activism, that story had been forgotten in some ways. And it was, the book was started in many ways as a angry response to something like Taylor Branch's book, which was subtitled America in the King Years. Titles like that drove me insane because I felt there are so many more people, so much more going on, and to lump it in that way was a disservice to the broader idea of the civil rights movement, and SNCC seemed a perfect vehicle to tell that broader story.
Well, let's talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It has become a proper noun, and even more so as SNCC, its pronunciation, if you will. Take it apart, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and go back to its origins. And am I correct? In 1960.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee grew out of the sit-ins, which was which happened first in February 1960, and then spread across the South like wildfire in the spring of 1960. What most people don't remember is that in 1960, what we think of the civil rights movement was flagging. It had been 6 years since the Brown decision, and less than 1% of African-American students in the South attended integrated schools.
For school integration was the Brown decision, right. Go ahead.
That's right. And the Montgomery bus boycott had happened a couple years before, but King himself had had trouble recreating its success, and so the movement was floundering. In fact, it was close to being stillborn, and then the sit-ins happened, and they recharged the protest and recharged the movement and set in motion almost everything we think about the 60s. So in many ways, the sit-ins are the seminal moment of the civil rights movement and of the 60s themselves.
Well, it's interesting, and I don't know how much of this story to retell, because people certainly are aware of a lot of it, but the sit-ins that we're talking about, among others, were simply about public accommodations for a person of African descent to be able to sit at a lunch counter or go into a certain door or use the same drinking fountain. Certainly everybody knows the drinking fountain story. So this was, almost incredible that by mid-century in in the 20th century that there had to be this movement for public accommodations, but it was met with incredible violence from a group that was committed to nonviolence, as its name states, right?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, one of the things about the sit-ins that made them different than something like the Montgomery bus boycott, which was during the boycott, people tried to avoid getting arrested. The point of the boycott was sort of to withdraw from segregation. But what the sit-ins did was confront segregation, get in its face. The whole point of sitting in was to be arrested, was to show the immorality of segregation by getting arrested. And that this confrontation was a real change from the kind of protest that had happened before, and was designed to really starkly show the American public how awful segregation was. So in that way, it was actually a lot more in this tradition of a kind of Gandhian nonviolence in its confrontation with evil than what King had been doing with the boycott, which was sort of challenging it by withdrawing. And there was a huge difference and a huge excitement and charge that people got by breaking the law, breaking this immoral law that they had been forced to obey for so long. People got a real charge about participating in a sit-in that was different than the kind of boycott, which felt in some ways more passive to participants. To not do something is more passive than to break the law.
You're not critical, though, are you, of that tactic? I thought that was an extraordinary event, the Montgomery bus boycott, where African Americans, led by soon to be a Detroiter, Rosa Parks, whole community moved in it, together to say, if we can't have our humanity, we'll walk.
That's exactly right, and I don't mean to be critical of the boycott so much as I would say that one of the problems of the boycott was, even as it pulled the community together, it was hard to reproduce and the boycott over and over again. And the sit-ins, as a simple tactic, were easy to reproduce over and over again. And in that way, they built on and extended the boycott and turned the civil rights movement into an even more of a mass movement. So I see it more as a kind of extension of the boycott, of building on it, rather than an either-or choice.
Well, let's do this. First, let me reintroduce you. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Andrew B. Lewis. He's written The Shadows of Youth, A Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation. And by now, hopefully, this is all coming back to you. If this is still foggy history, do yourself a favor and look it up, because it's an extraordinary, important, and exciting period in American history. And let's go to The Shadows of Youth. Tell me about the title, the Shadows of Youth. What are the shadows here? I was going to guess, but I'll let you declare.
Well, I thought of the title in three ways. One, that youth shadowed the civil rights movement in that it was young people at the forefront of it and who took charge of it. I also thought of the title in the ways in which the youth of the participants shadowed the rest of their lives. And one of the questions I had been interested in was, if you helped change the world before you were 30, what would the rest of your life feel like? And in many ways, people were shadowed by their youth. And thirdly, I thought of the title in the ways in which this is the moment in which the idea of youth really begins to shadow the American experience, and we become an even more youth-obsessed society, and we think of youth as a great concept. And so I thought of the title in all those different ways.
With the photograph, here are these very young people staring into the camera, and they're in a triangular shape. And Julian Bond, who you've co-authored a book with, maybe use him as a sort of exemplary of the path that one of your subjects in Shadows of Youth followed from his origins. And we could probably spend about an hour talking about Julian Bond, but maybe a brief look at his life.
Yeah, I think he's a great example. His father was a college administrator, and he grew up in outside of Philadelphia and also in Atlanta. He went to college at Morehouse and wasn't that involved in activism up to that point. And one of the things that's interesting about his life and the life of, say, Diane Nash from Chicago or Ivanhoe Donaldson from Detroit or many of the others is that after World War II, the African-American middle class expanded. It was still far behind the white middle class, but in absolute terms, it had grown much larger, and there were many more African-Americans going to college. And in many ways, they felt part of the youth culture of the 50s. They wore Levi's, they listened to Elvis as well as Chuck Berry, and yet their race set them apart. And so there were many kind of confusing messages being given. And in the picture you refer to, you can see Julian is dressed like an ordinary preppy 1950s teenager. And then the movement happens, and he becomes deeply involved in activism and spends his 20s working for SNCC and with SNCC, helping bring about change in the South. And in 1968, he becomes the youngest person to have his name placed in nomination for the vice presidency and becomes all of a sudden the most famous black man in America. And for a few years, he is one of the leading fundraisers for the Democratic Party. But his career, political career, fizzles out in part because there's not that many avenues in the South for African Americans to hold elective office. And he has a period where he's not sure what he wants to do with his life. And then in the 90s, he becomes chairman of the NAACP and helps revive that organization. And so one of the things about Julian that I think is great and exemplary of the story of many people in SNCC is that arc from sort of baby boomer to activist to community leader to a sort of establishment figure is embodied by many of the people in the book.
Now, he actually is, in some broad sense, a sort of a Barack Obama figure 30 years before.
That's right. That's right. And I always like to think that for a while, up until he got the nomination, one of the few people in America who could understand what it was like to be Barack Obama was Julian Bond, who had a career path very similar to him. He was elected to the state Senate. He made his name at a convention. He was an electrifying speaker. The difference, of course, was that in Illinois, there was a route for Obama now to get elected to the Senate and move his career forward. For Bond, in Georgia, there was no opportunity to move forward, and so his political career stalled. But for a while, his path was like Obama's from 2004 until 2007. Their lives were similar in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Media lives.
Andrew Lewis, you co-authored with Julian Bond, Gonna Sit at the Welcome Table, a documentary history of the civil rights movement. How did you guys are from different generations. You're from a younger generation. How did you hook up with him?
I was a grad student at the University of Virginia when Julian started teaching classes there, and we actually got to know each other. Funny enough, I went to Cal Ripken in 1996 when Ripken was breaking the record. Julian's wife is a huge baseball fan. Julian himself isn't. And they didn't have a TV in their apartment in Charlottesville, and I invited them over to watch the game. I ended up spending most of the night talking to Julian, and we became friendly after that. And in many ways, he inspired this book because he told me some really interesting stories about the kind of day-to-day life of the movement. And one of the things that I got out of those stories, which I've tried to do in the book, is that the civil rights movement, especially for the young people in SNCC, was one of the great adventure stories of the late 20th century. And then in addition to being scary and politically important, it was also completely exciting, great fun, and a great adventure in the sense that it was young people living low to the ground, on the road, hanging out together. There was a part of the story of the movement that I thought hadn't been told, which was that there was an element of fun mixed into the seriousness. And I think we often, our story is mostly about how serious it is. And then the activists become kind of as boring and dour as the Puritans, when in fact this was a completely exciting moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody on in the photograph on the cover of your book, The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, has a very serious look on their face. And I wonder, Andrew Lewis, if you could talk to us about white people, Euro-Americans, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, because right in back of Julian Bond, and I'm asking about too many questions at once, it's posed triangularly with Julian Bond at the center of it, and then right behind them are a white man and a white woman. Tell us some about how whites figured in SNCC, what their motivation was. If you know anything about the positioning of this people in this photograph, there's a lot of things there. So, but
that's a great question. The person in the photograph you're talking to is the first white person to join SNCC. His name was Bob Zellner. He was from Alabama, and his grandfather and father were both Klansmen, actually. Oh. And he went to college in Montgomery, Alabama, and he wanted to write a paper. He was in college in 1956 and when the boycott was going on, and he wanted to write a paper about it. And his teachers at college sent him only to the White Citizens Council and other segregationist groups for information, and he wanted to interview King, and they told him he couldn't, and this got him interested in the movement. And a few years later, he joined SNCC, becoming one of its most celebrated leaders. But in a broader sense, the SNCC inspired almost all of the what we call the New Left, the student movements of the 60s, and a perfect example of that is Tom Hayden, who was at the University of Michigan, who was the editor of the student paper, who was so excited about what the students were doing that he drove down south, participated in some of the protests, and sent back glowing articles to the Michigan newspaper about what was going on.
Also managed to get beaten pretty badly. There's a famous pamphlet that Tom Hayden wrote with him sitting nonviolently on the ground and some big bruiser slamming his fist into the side of his head.
That's right. That's in Macomb, Mississippi, when he went down to observe the protests and to participate and to meet the students. And Hayden is one of the bridges between SNCC and the anti-war movement and the New Left, the white New Left. And in many ways, SNCC inspired a generation of white college students to think about the ways in which they could protest and the ideals that they should be working for. So white students were both members of SNCC and, in a broader sense, inspired by it. They were, in many ways, the early members of SNCC were kind of like rock stars in the early to mid-1960s to a generation of activist college students and inspired by them.
Now, there is a number of huge personalities, people that in the period of the 60s were almost household names, and some of them came to a bad end, like H. Rapp Brown and to some extent Stokely Carmichael, depending on how you read that. Others, like John Lewis, went into Congress, Julian Bond, the head of the NAACP. Oh, I forgot Marion Barry, who certainly a checkered career. What any sense why... particularly, though, let's go for the ones that definitely came to some bad ends. H. Rapp Brown, who's serving a life sentence for killing a police officer, and Marion Barry, who's had incredible scrapes with the law. Why these people that were, I mean, there must have been some transformation there, that they were indignant about what was happening to African-American people, yet then somehow, got corrupted, or how would you read it?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple ways to read it. One thing that I think is interesting about the story is that the lives people led as they got older are as varied as the people themselves. But in the cases you're talking about, I think one of the things that we often forget is the personal cost of activism, which is to be an activist in the South during the early 1960s was, as I said, an adventure, but a scary adventure in which you were often fearful for your life, and that for many people, that took a deep psychological toll. And I think many of the SNCC activists suffered from a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder in the ways in which they were fighting a kind of domestic war. And the toll for some was heavier than others. And I would also say for Stokely Carmichael and for Marion Barry, to some extent, is that the skills that can make you a really good activist sometimes aren't always the skills that make you a really good politician or are really suited for other kinds of work. And so some people had a harder time making a transition to middle age than others. And so the fearlessness, the recklessness, the willingness to confront danger that can make you an amazing activist are not always the best skills for a middle-aged person trying to sort of eke out a career and do some other things. And so for them, it was hard to make the transition in some ways.
I can't believe how fast this interview is going, and because, you know, trying to sum up a whole period in American history, that's why Andrew Lewis has written The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, published by Hill and Wang. And at the end of SNCC's existence, I can't remember who said it, but he said that something they should change their name because they're not students, they're not nonviolent, they don't coordinate anything, and they're not a committee. And at one point, whites were expelled. And my history isn't strong enough to remember exactly either what caused that or what year that was.
Yeah, it happened in 1966. And for example, Bob Zellner, who was one of SNCC's most celebrated members, was thrown out, and he actually came back again to see if he could reaffiliate with SNCC. And it came out in part because, even as I talk about the civil rights generation, one thing that was true about the early activists of SNCC is how fast they burned out. The years from 1960 to 1966 felt like a lifetime. And I think one thing to remember about this and about the kind of frustration that led to expelling whites was we often think of that as an internal change, which is that activists became more black nationalistic or that they became more exclusive. In many ways, the change was external, which is they were disappointed in the failure of the federal government to live up to the promises of the Voting Rights Act, to live up to the promises of the Civil Rights Act, and that they were seeking new tactics, new ways to address that. And that one of the things they thought about was that they needed black political power, not because they were nationalistic, but because whites weren't willing to work in coalitions, that the federal government wasn't doing what it should to protect, even after the Voting Rights Act, protect black voters, to help people register to vote. So in many ways, the change was a kind of change of external frustration rather than an internal change of ideology, even though we often see it that way. And one of the things I tried to get across in my book is how disappointed we should be in the federal government's weak response to the civil rights activists, not just early on, but throughout the 1960s. The federal government did the minimum possible all the time to help the activists, and their role should be criticized more than it should be celebrated.
The book is The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation. My guest on The Peter Werbe Show has been Andrew B. Lewis, the author. Publishers Weekly says, with deep admiration and rigorous scholarship, historian Lewis reveals the ragtag band of young men and women who formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. With this eloquent book, he offers a deserved tribute. Well worth picking up and getting another aspect of American history into our brains. I've neglected to ask you before, is there a website dedicated to this book, or should we send them to Hill and Wang, which is fsgbooks.com?
Yeah, there is a there's a page dedicated to the book at redroom.com, which is our site for writers. And if you look under Andrew Lewis or Shadows of Youth, there's a page dedicated to the book with a blog about some upcoming events and other things, places for people to write comments and things like that.
Also, I'll put a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and you can link from there as well. Andrew Lewis, been great. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? Having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Jeez, Q, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
It's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet? No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
No.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
My name's Rachel, and I'm 10 years old. I like riding my bike, playing soccer, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. My friends will drink, so I will too.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
My parents won't really know what's going on yet. I mean, I'll do okay in school, but when I drink, I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
Alcohol affects their judgment and their future. So start talking before they start drinking.
My parents won't believe it could happen to me.
For more information on teens and alcohol, and to learn what you can do, visit the web at stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Peter Werbe here with you. Thanks for joining me on this broadcast. There's always been this incredible fascination with crime and punishment in this, probably everywhere, but through movies beginning in the 1930s, but even back into the 19th century with Billy the Kid and some of the famous outlaws back then. They made all the tabloids back east. And today you can see that, you know, the crime television series and how much they're viewed and what have you. Back in the 30s and the 40s, though, what really stood out were two prisons. One was in New York, Sing Sing. That's where all the New York gangsters got sent, to Sing Sing, unless they committed federal crimes, because the big prison, the one that was in everyone's mind, was Alcatraz. And we have a fascinating new book, one that's come my way. It's called Alcatraz, The Gangster Years, and David Ward has written it along with Gene Kassenbaum. And David Ward is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Minnesota. He's a co-author of Prison Treatment and Parole Survival and co-editor of Confinement and Maximum Custody, New Last Resort Prisons in the United States and Europe. And Professor Ward has served as a consultant to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary for an investigation of Alcatraz's successor, the federal penitentiary at Marion, Illinois. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining me, David Ward, who joins us from San Francisco. Can you see Alcatraz from your house?
No, I can't quite see it, but I know it's there.
Give us the locations. The nickname of it is The Rock, right?
That's right. It's a rocky little island in the midst of San Francisco Bay, and when it was first proposed as a prison for the desperados and gangsters of the 1930s, it was not appreciated by the residents of San Francisco. They didn't want to look out from their view on the beautiful bay and see a place that came to be called America's Devil's Island.
Well, Alcatraz, it's so iconic in American folklore, and then it says you trace the lives of infamous criminals who passed through the penitentiary from 1934 to 1948, but it was open longer than that, right?
Yes, this is part of a comprehensive investigation of what life was like on the Rock and what happened to the prisoners after they finally were released. This book covers the era for which Alcatraz is best known, that is the era of the public enemies, when Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly and Alvin Karpus and Doc Barker were housed there, and when the regime was at its toughest, when they had the silent system and they put inmates in underground dungeons, cells that had absolutely nothing in them, and chained them during the daytime, standing to the bars in front. It was a controversial prison from the very beginning. It's the kind of schizophrenia we have in this country between those who don't think the punishment is ever enough and those who think that punishment can be too much and create at Alcatraz and at its successors inmates who are severely psychologically damaged by the harsh regimes. Controversy that continues today.
It sure does. I was going to say, this sounds kind of familiar, particularly the treatment.
Well, at Alcatraz, we have a prime example of the federal government identifying over the 30 years the prison was open 1,550 inmates and offenders who were described as habitual and incorrigible. They were hopeless in terms of any kind of redemption or rehabilitation. And therefore, Alcatraz, during its 3 decades, never had a social worker, a psychologist, a teacher, a vocational training instructor. It was just plain doing time.
Which is the name of a book by Morton Sobel, or Sobel, it's called On Doing Time. Now, he was federally prosecuted, involved with the Rosenberg atomic spy case. Now, why was he there?
Alcatraz and its successors at Marion, Illinois, and today at Florence, Colorado, have always housed the country's most notorious offenders. In the Alcatraz era, it was people like Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly, and later on the Birdman and other 1950s-era gangsters, Mickey Cohen. Then when Marion took Alcatraz roll on in 1983, it housed John Gotti, Carlos Later, the drug dealer, and a number of spies and traitors. And today, its successor at Florence, Colorado, called Alcatraz of the Rockies, houses Massawi, the shoe bomber, the Unabomber, and other people who are seen as the most serious federal law violators. Now, in all three eras, Alcatraz, Marion, and Florence, the number of high-profile, what we might call celebrity prisoners, is really tiny, about 5% of the prison population. The rest of them are the federal prison system's most notorious escape artists, prison hellraisers, its most violent offenders, its most serious management problems. But they are known for the high-profile prisoners, just as Alcatraz is known for housing Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly and the Birdman.
Mm-hmm. Alcatraz, The Gangster Years is the book that we're talking about. Its co-author, David Ward, who's written the book along with Gene Kassebaum, is my guest here on the Peter Werby Show. And your work, as we can see by the books that you've written and co-authored and edited, have to do with confinement and the whole prison culture. So 1934, this was the era, as you indicate, the gangster years, where there were these dangerous, a lot of them from the Midwest, a lot of dangerous criminals, as you said, Machine Gun Kelly and Alvin Karpis, Al Capone from Chicago and what have you. Was there a need? Was there actually a need for Alcatraz?
Well, the federal government certainly thought so, because there was a wave of kidnappings of wealthy businessmen across the country, and this followed in 1932, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. It was seen that local police were incompetent, inept, were being outgunned and outrun by gangsters with machine guns and fast cars and a lot of careful planning. And the local governments felt that only the federal government could deal with this cross-state, cross-county crime wave. And the Attorney General at the time felt that there needed to be a symbolic prison for the worst of the worst, and that Alcatraz, a former military prison, was picked as the location. And to Alcatraz went the people who survived the shootouts with FBI agents and local sheriffs. Lots of them, of course, went down. John Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, and so forth. But those who lived, Machine Gun Kelly, Alvin Karpis, Doc Barker, the members of Detroit's Purple Gang, all ended up at Alcatraz. So in some ways, during the 1930s and 1940s, when this collection of people, sort of an all-star team of crime, were at Alcatraz, it was a really unique population of very high-profile federal offenders all locked up and doing time with each other.
You know, you mentioned earlier, and I meant, in fact, I'm going to do that right now, mentioned I was going to ask you to explain some. You mentioned something about a policy of silence, and I was wondering, here are all these famous gangsters together. Did they just have a good old time together and sort of hang out and swap stories?
Well, there were lots of old friends and old associates, and of course some of them had become not so friendly and felt associates had done the wrong thing and let them down during bank robberies and so forth. But nevertheless, Alcatraz was a place that was operated under the convict code. The convict code, this is the golden era of the convict code, when inmates were supposed to not make trouble for each other. Their only job was to make trouble for the staff. They were supposed to be supportive. It was the era of solidarity, that if the strike was called, everyone was supposed to participate. As far as daily life was concerned, in a prison that had no programs, and which had no commissary, no movies, no newspapers, there was very little to do except to read, and inmates at Alcatraz read an average of 90 books a year. Huh. Did they get along with each other? Yes. It's really remarkable how few fights there were, and during Alcatraz's 30-year history, there were only 8 killings of inmates by other inmates, and that compared to Alcatraz's successor at Marion, Illinois, is a small number. In Marion, by the time the place was finally locked down and returned to an Alcatraz regime in 1983, 25 inmates had been killed by other prisoners. Hmm. So this is the era of the convict code, and when I've interviewed inmates at Marion and at Florence, Colorado, the two successor institutions, they all extol the good old days when the convicts hung together, didn't try to kill each other, and when they were organized and unified against the regime and against the staff.
But in your book, Alcatraz, the Gangster Years, you talk about actually there were protests and strikes. Can you tell us some about that? That seems fairly unusual for prisons, although, of course, in the 1950s, there were some, there was a massive strike and occupation by the inmates at Jackson Prison here in Michigan. Of course, there's the famous Attica. But what form did they take at Alcatraz?
Well, if you take the most dedicated troublemakers from the entire federal prison system and you lock them up on an island where the regime is locked up, everyone is locked up at 4:45 in the afternoon, there is really nothing to do except, as I said, read books, it would be unreasonable to expect that that group of prisoners wouldn't organize to protest various features of their confinement. The trains bringing prisoners to Alcatraz in August and September of 1934 arrived at the island, and on October 1st, 1934, the inmates had already organized in the first strike. What could they do? They could refuse to work. They could refuse to eat. They were dedicated escape artists, and some of the greatest escapes in American penal history, of course, occurred at Alcatraz. The best known of these, of course, is the 1962 escape of the Anglin brothers that is featured in the Clint Eastwood movie Escape from Alcatraz. The Birdman and his protest took the form of first killing a guard at Leavenworth, which is how he ended up with a life in solitary confinement sentence, and then ultimately shipment to Alcatraz. The inmates always were protesting. They were protesting in the early days, the diet, the lack of movies and so forth. They didn't get anything, but the organization was important for inmates to, as the criminologist John Irwin says, to maintain their integrity, to stand up against the regime and show that they still were not going to put up with the minutia of rules that covered every single aspect of daily life. Mm. And as our project showed, that over the years, the prisoners who rebelled against the regime, who got the largest number of prison misconduct reports, were more likely to succeed after release, that is, not return to prison, than the so-called model prisoners who adjusted to the regime and didn't make any trouble.
Well, David Ward, you've co-authored, as well as your current book on Alcatraz, a book called Prison Treatment and Parole Survival, which speaks to what you just mentioned. But tell us some about the prison regimes themselves of Alcatraz. I mean, we hear about these horror stories of the way prisons in the South during the 30s, quite a long time, and even some today, must be quite a situation for the guards and the administration to be locked up almost similarly to the prisoners. What was the nature of the regime, and how would you evaluate from your studies how they functioned?
Well, Alcatraz, it should be noted, involved the psychological pain of imprisonment compared to the southern prisons, where inmates were being beaten and living in inhumane, barbaric conditions, where inmates were hired as shotgun guards to shoot any inmate who tried to escape. Alcatraz was really a very benign environment because there wasn't any physical brutality. Now, I say that not only based on an evaluation of the records of the institution, but interviews with 54 inmates, including people who were there at the very beginning. The time at Alcatraz was the boredom, the endless boredom, and the lack of activities. As I said, everybody was locked up for the night at 4:45. There were no programs of any kind at Alcatraz. It created an atmosphere that was like a monastery, and inmates talked about the number of hours in which they sat in their cells trying to remember what had happened to their families, that their wives were living with someone else, their children were being raised by other people. Mother died a year ago, and they couldn't go to the funeral. And during these years of solitary contemplation, they divided up the number of years that they got for the bank robberies that they had committed, and the rate wasn't very good. What was happening at Alcatraz, and it's true for its successor federal penitentiaries, is that the wonders of the aging process kicked in. And as inmates got older, they got more reflective. They were tired of doing time. They were tired of living with the other convicts. They wanted to breathe the air of the free world before they died. And they made conscious decisions to stop the lives of crime that they had been running and gunning in for their early years. And to our surprise, 63% of the public enemy era gangsters, the hopeless incorrigibles, succeeded when they returned to the free world in never coming back to prison.
The book is Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. David Ward has written it, along with Gene Kassenbaum. And you're listening to The Peter Werby Show. You can go to ucpress.edu and find the book. Also, I'll have a link on my site, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. You mentioned escapes, and I just vaguely remember Escape from Alcatraz, the movie that you mentioned, and a few people trying to swim. I mean, tell us, were there escape attempts, and how many were successful?
Well, if you mean getting to the land, there was only one escape that was successful. In 1962, a prisoner named John Paul Scott was able to cut the bars in the basement area of the kitchen where he was working. He and another prisoner had the cord from an industrial floor polishing machine. They climbed up some drains to the top of the prison using the cord, dropped down on the other side, and got into the water of the bay. And the first prisoner was not a good swimmer and only made it to a small rock right off the western side of the island of Alcatraz. But John Paul Scott had some flotation gear made out of surgical gloves that he had was able to blow up, and and secure the bottoms, and floated along past San Francisco to the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, where when he tried to get out of the water, he was being subjected to hypothermia. It was so cold out of the water, and the rocks were covered with barnacles. He was struggling. A couple on the bridge saw him, notified the bridge authorities. The military came and picked him up, and everyone assumed he was a jumper from the bridge. Took him to the Army hospital nearby, and even the staff at Alcatraz didn't send anybody over to see him until hours later when someone told a junior officer, go over to Letterman Hospital and check out this guy who jumped off the bridge. And there was their prisoner. John Paul Scott showed that you could get out of Alcatraz, get along in the current of the waters, get over to the San Francisco side, and if he had gone right around the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, there was a sandy beach. He didn't dare to try it. He decided that that was convict talk, and if he didn't make it, the next stop for him would be Honolulu. So he tried to get over those rocks. Years later, when I interviewed him and showed him the pictures of that beach, you hear me on my tape-recorded interview saying, as he's saying, oh, my God, I almost make it, and you hear me apologizing for showing him the pictures. It would be better if he hadn't known how close he came to being the really successful escapee from Alcatraz.
It's surprising that that some gangster didn't arrange to like be picked up in a speedboat or something like, you know, they did these helicopter escapes from a few prisons around the world. But
well, this is, of course, before the helicopter era, which did occur and is something that's planned against that Alcatraz successor institutions. The idea of a speedboat coming by and picking up Al Capone and his cronies was a constant threat, but there were armed guards and gun towers all around Alcatraz, and of course for part of its period from 1941 to 46, the bay was filled with military boats, and the security on the prison was sufficient to keep inmates when they were locked up at night. All of the escape attempts, almost all of them, occurred from buildings that were where inmates went to work, where they were much closer to the water, and they didn't have to try to escape from the cell house itself. The Alcatraz inmates were dedicated to escape. If you had interviewed John Paul Scott, the man whose escape I just described, and you'd say, my gosh, I see you've got a sentence here, you're doing 35 years, and he would say, well, it's really not a concern to me because I don't figure I'll be here that long. They had the idea that they could get out, and these are the days before the electronic fences, the lethal fences, the technology that now makes escape from high-security prisons almost impossible. In those days, it could be done, and the inmates were dedicated to trying it.
You know, we're almost out of time. When did Alcatraz close, and why did it close?
It closed in March of 1963 because the new Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, did not like the image in an era, the era of rehabilitation was just becoming important, and he did not want the federal government to be operating a prison that was dedicated only to punishment, that was called Helcatraz, the Rock of Despair, America's Devil's Island. These were all images that the federal government wanted to avoid, and so Robert Kennedy ordered that Alcatraz be closed and its inmates be dispersed to other prisons.
Let me interrupt you because we've got only about a minute left. This is an extraordinarily interesting story, Alcatraz, the Gangster Years, which we barely scratched the surface. Professor Ward's book is over 500 pages long. In about 30 or 40 seconds, are there lessons here, though, for instance, for Guantanamo?
Well, they talked about Guantanamo today in hearings before a Senate committee, and the name of Alcatraz came up, partly because of its great symbolism. But Alcatraz and its successors at Marion, Illinois, are places where the worst of the worst for decades have been confined, and confined successfully. I'm myself mystified as to why politicians would feel that we do not have facilities facilities in this country that could contain even the high-profile detainees from Guantanamo.
And actually, I'm pleased. I was a minute short of looking at my clock. What's fascinating to me that you were able to interview all these alumni. And are they ever in contact with one another? Is there some old convicts group or anything?
Well, there was. Most of these men, of course, now are dead. There is a group called the Alcatraz Alumni Association that really was established by the staff members of Alcatraz. But as far as the Alcatraz convicts are concerned, this is a really unique group of people who have done serious time in a high-security penitentiary and are proud of having been there. So we found that they were quite anxious to talk to us about their stories and the famous personalities on the island with whom they did time. The point about Alcatraz is the surprising success rate after release for the entire population, that is the whole 30 years, of 50%, it raises the questions of what happened to the hopeless incorrigibles that they turned around, and it raises some questions about how long, we're not talking about the Gitmo detainees now, but how long the high security prisoners who are maintained in our state and federal supermaxes need to be contained and locked up before they would be safe to be returned to society. Secondly, the inmates of Alcatraz were not driven mad by the regime, Spartan and difficult as it was. It doesn't mean they weren't affected by their experience, but only 8% of the inmates at Alcatraz showed serious mental health problems, and a number of them brought their problems with them when they came to the island. The final point I would like to make is that the bad actors, as I told you, the people with the most misconduct reports, did better after release than the model prisoners. That raises some questions about parole boards, which traditionally hold it against you if you have violated prison rules, regarding it as a measure of unlikely success after release. Alcatraz raises some serious questions about the confinement of inmates under many, many years in supermax regimes.
An absolutely fascinating book, Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. David Ward's been my guest. He co-authored the book with Gene Kassebaum. It's available from the University of California Press. You can go to ucpress.edu. It'll be on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Professor Ward, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187. Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts assets for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Do you know someone who always seems well-connected? Here's your chance to one-up that person and then some. Welcome to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online connection to half-off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses. Simply log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com for special online coupons and discounts you can't get anywhere else.
This week's featured deal is Roz and Friends Hair Salon in Troy and Premier Pet Supply in Beverly Hills.
All you have to do is visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. You'll save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your computer. Heck, you don't even have to get dressed. No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Shop naked.